Okay. I'd like to welcome everyone to the California Council of the Blind Convention, and more particularly, the joint session of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision and the Committee on Access and Transportation. I'm the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. To my left is Bernice Kandarian, the president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision, and we wish to welcome you this morning. And just to let everyone know that we are having this presentation recorded for the organization, but also there is public access TV station KDRT that's here who have asked to film this workshop, and our presenters have all said that it's okay with them, so hopefully it's okay with you, so that this will be something that will be rebroadcast in the Davis area. The subject, as you've read, is disaster preparedness, and that covers floods, earthquakes, fire, other terrorist attacks, so forth. And this is a timely subject with a lot of the things that have been occurring in the United States recently, and it's timely. Today, we're anticipating a big electrical storm tonight and some local flooding. Nothing that I think we got to fear here. We lost two levees just a few days ago.
Good news, Gene.
Yeah. But it was agricultural land, fortunately. It was not within any of the urban settings. So we have today with three speakers with us. They're all going to give their different perspectives on preparedness, primarily but not exclusively targeted for the population of persons who are blind or visually impaired. I believe they're going to be talking a little bit about service animals, and probably I'm going to interject this, those of you who may not have service animals but have pets, and that would be some of the things to be touching upon. Some of the things are going to be very similar they're going to be touching upon, but they're all going to be offering different perspectives to it. Before we introduce our first speaker, I'd like to ask Bernice if she would like to make any open comments.
I just want to welcome everybody, and especially all the people with low vision. And we have a resolution that we are putting forth, and we would, when it comes up, we'll ask for your support for that. And the lady from the TV station said it's K-Dirt. What did you say?
Where the grassroots grow.
Where the grassroots grow. Okay.
Just give me a second. Okay. Our first speaker is Mike Collins, who is the executive director of the California State Independent Living Center, who has been for the past 35 years very actively involved in disaster preparedness, working with high-risk populations, and about 17 years in the independent living field. He's on numerous national and state committees working on this subject, numerous accommodations, awards that he's gotten over the years. And I'm going to turn it over to Mike, and he could maybe tell a little more about himself and get into his subject. Thank you. Mike Collins.
Thank you, Gene. 35 years seems like a long time ago before emergency preparedness was a buzzword, but actually at that time I was an officer on the railroad, and we used to ship a lot of hazardous materials, and I used to go around to local fire departments and teach them how to handle hazardous materials and derailments. And of course, when we think of hazards, we don't often think of that even in Sacramento, but if you're sitting at a train crossing anywhere, it's a potential emergency just waiting to happen. My presentation is called Emergency Preparedness for People with Vision Loss. I know that covers people with low vision, people who are blind, people who haven't lost their vision but never had it, and those of us who are losing their vision as we get older. So actually, a lot of what I'm going to tell you today is applicable to everybody. It's applicable to your family, your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers, and the whole works. But we all have a need to be responsible for our own preparedness, our own family preparedness, and in disasters, we've learned, unfortunately, last fall with Katrina and several things that have happened in California, that you can't count on somebody else to come in and rescue you and make everything right again. If you are prepared, you're going to be far better off whenever something occurs. And we joked about having a couple of levee breaks around here that flooded farmland. Today they've got a road shut down in Stockton because a levee broke in Stockton this morning. So this is everywhere. And if you're on an upper floor of this hotel tonight, don't worry about getting wet. I do want to do a little disclaimer here this morning. I didn't invent all the material you're going to hear about today. This has been gathered from a variety of resources. If you've picked up the CD and the handout, or the handout, or both, you're going to have access to all these resources. They're all available on the internet or by ordering them from organizations. I'm fortunate to be joined here today by Anna Marie and by Mitch, who are also very much involved in this. And we've got Richard DeVelder in the back of the room from the Department of Rehab. He's been very quiet, but you can corner him afterwards. And the Department of Rehabilitation is a partner with the State Independent Living Council, and we work on trying to make it safer for people with disabilities to live independently. And in doing so, they have to live safely. You can't live alone or live in the community with your family independently if you're not thinking about your safety. Why do we worry about people with disabilities and disasters? I mean, we talk about vulnerable populations and how important it is to protect everybody. But see, we're 20% of the population. We're kind of the barometer. If you can't protect the vulnerable populations, the people with disabilities, the seniors, and the children, the rest of the population is going to have a pretty tough time, too. So the reason that we're the barometer is because many of us are unable to evacuate ourselves in an emergency, so we've got to do some pre-planning on transportation. A lot of us can't contact help in an emergency. And, of course, we all know that if the power goes out or the phone lines go down, that's a great equalizer. Nobody can contact help in an emergency. Some of us lack the ability to see approaching danger, or others lack the ability to hear evacuation announcements. And oftentimes, we don't know where to go. If you're in a house and it's nighttime and you have a fire, everybody has vision loss. I can't see in that situation. And as people have cognitive disabilities or mental disabilities, oftentimes we get confused and not know where to go. Why do we need to worry? Well, we have people here from throughout the state, and we have floods in the Sacramento area, in the San Joaquin Valley. We have floods in Southern California. Those fancy deserts down there get flooded all the time. Earthquakes. We don't think of Sacramento as an earthquake zone, but if we have a big shaker in this area, all those levees are going to turn to mud. So we're going to have earthquakes and flood. Fires, the wildfires in California are well known. We've had some of the biggest disasters, and I'll be talking about what we've learned from those. Terrorists, we have to think we're still a target somewhere down the road. And things like power outages and hurricanes, they're just tornadoes. Now, I never thought California had tornadoes. We had 38 of them in Northern California last spring. They didn't do any damage, but they're here. Derailments, I mentioned those earlier. I used to clean up derailments for a living, and I've seen the damage that can happen. And those train tracks run through every community in this state. Riots, now, there's some things going on this week in some of the major cities, L.A., for instance, where you get a few hundred thousand people out in the streets, and somebody decides to turn over a car, and suddenly you've got problems. And there have been some very well-publicized riots taking place in parts of our state. We have to think a little bit about another kind of emergency now. We've been attending summits lately on the flu pandemic that might strike the world. In 1918, we had 40 million people killed by the Spanish flu. They say today that if the bird flu had the same type of mortality rate it has now at 54%, that we would lose hundreds of millions or more people to that flu. And when those type of disasters strike the country, they shut down transportation systems. A lot of public safety workers aren't there. And so our own personal preparedness is even more important. Landslides, mudslides, we've seen parts of California slide into the ocean and slide onto the highways, so if you're living in an area that has to worry about that. No matter how different these disasters appear, there's really some basic lessons that occur. And we have mainly five or six items that I want to talk about today. One is disaster planning, and that's part of what you're doing here today. Disaster preparation is what I hope you're going to do when you get home and what you're going to talk about with your family and your neighbors and your coworkers. The notification process, which is critical for a lot of us who are disabled. The evacuation process, which if you can't drive yourself or you don't have access to a vehicle, is critical in any emergency. Shelter. I don't know how many of you have tried to get a service animal into a shelter lately, but that's a big time issue. And those of us who are in wheelchairs or have other types of conditions that require a little personal care attendant work once in a while, we have the same problems. And then how about the recovery? When you get home after a flood or a fire and you have to clean up the mess, how are you going to handle that? I want to talk about those issues and how we can be prepared as a population. You know, disability inclusion in the planning process is a requirement of the ADA. I'm sure you all knew that. But your local fire department, your local emergency services people should not be planning for that community and what's going to happen in your community in a disaster unless you're at the table or your organization's represented. How many of you besides Mitch have been involved in some of that local or regional planning? Okay, I see three hands, and Anna Marie's wiggling her fingers, so I know she has too, and I know Richard has, and I think it's extremely important in the back of the room, but you're married to Mitch, so that doesn't count. So, we're not talking about just your own city or your neighborhood. We're talking about statewide regional planning as well. So if you have an interest in this and you want to educate yourself and be a resource for the offices of emergency services everywhere, you need to be ready to sit down and serve on those committees. We need to also be sure that the needs of all types of people with disabilities are considered. And now people with disabilities are all ages, so you'll hear a lot of planning around frail elderly and vulnerable seniors. That's us too. I look around this room and there's several of you that have my gray hair or lack of it. So I know that you all fit in the same boat I do. But we've got people with mobility impairments, like myself. We have people with cognitive or psychiatric disabilities who have similar problems and disasters, maybe not exactly alike. The disaster preparation problems in past disasters is we've had problems with notification, as I mentioned. There were no backup methods for notification. A lot of people don't keep batteries around for those radios. You know, most of your clock alarm radios have a battery backup in them, so they'll operate for a while. People don't even have batteries in their houses. A lot of first aid supplies, food, and water weren't stored in homes and in community centers. The medication, is anybody here on Medi-Cal, or were you on Medi-Cal before you became Medicare? You know that it was impossible to get some meds stored up. You need a 10-day supply all the time, and you couldn't get advanced medication. So this is a problem that we're still working on. It's not solved yet. A lot of homes, if you live out in the country, people didn't have fire breaks around their home. And if you can't clear that yourself, you're going to have to find somebody else to do it. Many of us, many vulnerable people, people with disabilities, had no evacuation plans. They didn't know how to get out of their house in a fire. They wouldn't know how to get out of the neighborhood if there wasn't a bus running. So we have to work on those things. A lot of our local independent living centers, and we've got 65 offices around the state, they weren't looking at this as an issue. And it does have to be an issue in everybody's mind. Durable medical goods haven't been stockpiled. After Katrina, we had to send down about 6,000 wheelchairs from around the country in order to replace the equipment that was left at the New Orleans Convention Center when they shipped the buses out. They took all these nursing home residents and they showed the bus driving away, and there's a pile of 40 wheelchairs sitting there in the parking lot. And they got to the shelters, and there was no way for them to move anybody. It was poorly planned. And, of course, the big thing on preparation is we've got to break down the barriers and get these shelter sites accepting service animals. What's that all about? Notification, there's really a haphazard notification system in this country. No matter where you live, you know, you're going to get a telephone call from 911, maybe, the reverse 911 system. You may get something on your television. If you happen to be watching television, you'll hear the blaring warnings on radio, if you can hear the radio. But if you're in a remote area, a lot of those television and radio signals aren't available. There are people in California that live in the mountains, that live out in the deserts, and they can't receive those signals. A lot of the warning messages aren't accessible to people who are blind or deaf. You can put a scrolling caption on the bottom of the screen that says, you know, evacuate the Sacramento Valley. And if they don't have an audio announcement on there at the same time, how many of you would not hear that? Yeah, most of you in this room, including me, if I happen to be working on my computer and not watching the TV at the same time, which is my habit. A lot of the evacuation orders were confusing. They told people to evacuate, but they didn't tell them where to go. And we had an apartment complex with several people with cognitive disabilities down in San Bernardino. They said evacuate. They came outside, and the buses were running both directions. They didn't know which one to get on. And there were a lot of inadequate, there was no time from the time the evacuation orders were given until the actual event occurred. During the evacuation, a lot of the traffic jams, I'm not going to go through all of these, but I would say that you're going to get some of this out of that report, and we've got to look for all of these type of problems reoccurring in the past. The paratransit system, which we all... How many of you have ever used paratransit?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, everybody's hands went up. Now, the paratransit systems need to train their drivers and get certification for them to be able to operate as emergency vehicles to help evacuate people, because the paratransit systems know where you all live. They know whether or not you're at work or at home during the day, and they also can go in and out of those emergency zones with the right training to be able to get people out. And rather than just making one trip, we found that we had a lot of problems with them getting back into evacuation zones during the fires down south. We need to make sure that family members also know where you are and know that you need to be evacuated in an emergency. And a lot of the lists that are available to identify people with disabilities in this state and across the nation are outdated or unavailable during an emergency. In San Diego County, they had lists available from the local Aging and Adult Services Agency that had been given to all the fire departments. But when the fire started, the firemen were at the fires. They weren't at the station. 4 days later, they came back to get some fresh boots, and somebody pulled it out of the drawer and said, oh, we should check on these people. That doesn't always work. We've got to make the shelters accessible. I've said that. We've got to make sure the communication equipment is accessible, that the interpreters and caregivers are at the shelters if that's where people are going to go, and make sure that volunteers with disabilities aren't turned away like have happened in past disasters. You know, we can do a lot. We can sit there and keep track of who's coming and going. We can make sure the supplies are distributed, or we can pass on messages. If you have a television set up on the wall that's got captioning on it, it's like going to a sports bar and watching a game without captioning. You can't hear a thing. So we need to make sure the messages get out to everybody. And, of course, the service animal issue in the shelters. And, boy, I expect a big lobbying push from the people in this room when you go home to get a hold of your local shelter operators, get a hold of the American Red Cross, and try to break down that barrier. And, of course, since state and federal funds bring with them a requirement that their programs will be accessible, it's uncanny how they've gone that far. After an emergency, if you're in a rental situation and your housing is damaged or destroyed and you have to move somewhere else, A lot of times you can't find a place you can afford in California. And after any countywide or area-wide disaster, can you believe they raise the rents afterwards? What's that about? And for a lot of people in disasters, stress and mental anguish cause problems for a long time afterwards. If some psychological counseling isn't available, as a result, there can be an increase in depression and even suicide rates, and that's there's documentation about that across the country after 9/11 in New York and after the even the wildfires. They had a lot of counselors down there to try to work with people. And most disasters cause a lot of ongoing health problems. There's been a paradigm shift in disaster planning in the last couple of years, and I think it's related. It started back in 9/11, and it's gone, has really spread. And I think we've seen down in Katrina that there's some things you have to think about. You have to be prepared for more than one situation. Not everybody's going to be notified and evacuated on time. We have the need to evacuate with advance notice. That's, you know, that's kind of the Cadillac. That doesn't happen very often. A lot of people are told to evacuate immediately. I live down the pocket area of Sacramento. I've recently learned that when there's a flood, in an hour and 10 minutes, I'm going to have 17 feet of water in my living room. Well, my house is only about 15 feet high, so my living room is going to have goldfish in it. But if I'm still there, I'm going to be in it, and that's not good. So we're going to get an immediate notice to evacuate, and hopefully there'll be somebody there to help me get out of bed and into my chair and into my van and out of there. Sometimes we're going to have to remain in place for hours and even for days, we've found out, like after Katrina. Of course, some of those people they still haven't found, but they stayed there far too long. And we may have to stay there without utilities. There may be no electricity, no phones, and no water, no fresh water. So we've got to remember public transportation may not be operating. A lot of times roads are blocked. We have a few windstorms around here once in a while, and if you have flooding, the same situation. There might be external hazards outside if you've got power lines down, if it's some kind of a terrorist incident, a derailment, hazardous materials, accident on the highway, there may be gases in the air and you won't be able to leave your house. And do we have the ability to evacuate ourselves? That's critical as well. If you don't, that transportation and that evacuation need to be your primary concerns. We've got to take the responsibility to know how to shut off our utilities. How many of you know where your breaker box is in your house?
What?
Yeah, your breaker box for your utilities, for your electricity? Okay. A lot of us do know, but some of us don't. I can't get to mine. It's outside my house. I won't ask you this, but how many people know how to contact the emergency help that's going to help them get out of there? And that's a critical one. We need to inventory and record our belongings and our data, you know, our family data. I recommend that not only do you record it, but that you store it in a manner that if it gets wet, it'll still be usable. And if you've got a safety deposit box, that you keep copies of everything there. How many of you are registered with your local 911 network, with the fire and emergency, police, whatever you have going? Only a couple of hands raised, and that's a major concern. If you need evacuation assistance in emergencies, they have secure data kept in most fire and police stations now that's on their network, and they can key on you if they end up evacuating a neighborhood. So it's important to do that. Some of the old concerns about privacy, you call your local fire department's public number, not 911, don't call 911, and ask them if you can be registered for evacuation assistance in a case of emergency. Mitch, yes, Mitch.
Now, I wish it were that easy. A city the size of Los Angeles, we don't have that system in place yet. We are looking at it. We're meeting with some resistance. Our police and fire people are really hesitant to do it. What I say to folks is that system is necessary, but we may have to go back to our local communities and start advocating for it, because I know it exists in Culver City, a suburb of Los Angeles. I don't know if Jerry's here, but the person that I spoke to said that very few people, in fact, are signed up. So even when there is such a system in place, It's not well utilized, but it isn't something that's widespread yet, so we need to start advocating for that. That's what I'm trying to do in L.A., but we've got a way to go.
Okay, I don't know if I'm not going to open it up for questions now. I'm going to ask. Have question time afterwards, I hope. Yeah, but I'm going to take 2 minutes of Mitch's time when the time comes to. Mitch explained that this isn't available in Los Angeles yet, but we do have it in a lot of other communities. Sacramento just started it. Oakland's had it for years. Berkeley's had it. So it all depends on your local community. But if you don't have it, it's easily available to them. They can set it up. And all of your 911 systems anymore are computer controlled. They don't have old paper lists. When you pick up the phone and call 911, they see your phone and your address and maybe even your name, so they can actually have extra numbers in there. How many of you have ID chips implanted in your service animals in case they get lost or you get separated? Okay, I'm glad to see that most of you who have them do have them, but that's one thing that everybody needs to do. And also, it's a good idea for your pets. After Katrina, they shipped the pets across the country. We had 450 dogs from the Gulf Coast in Sacramento. I think there were only about 10 of those that had chips in there so they could eventually be reunited with their owners. And so it doesn't make any sense not to do it. Your dog has no privacy concerns, or even your cat. You know, so they would prefer to be back home with you and getting their favorite kind of dog food than what some stranger is going to feed them. I can guarantee you that.
Mike?
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could I just add one little thing to that?
Sure.
And this I got from the United Animal Nation, and that is that it helps the shelters that if you also take a picture of yourself with your animal so that if you're trying to recover that animal, that at least if there's a picture there, they can see that some way of verifying that you really are the legitimate owner, because they had some problems in Katrina where there were people who wanted pets who weren't the owners who were trying to take these animals away.
Right, and that's farther down the presentation line, but thanks for bringing it up early, Gene. So, had to put this together early. So, and make sure that if you're living in or working in a fire, earthquake, or flood zone, you know, if you're in a fire zone, clear all that debris and move the firewood away from the house. Identify your evacuation routes. Arrange for backup notification and some transportation assistance if you need it. And set up some phone trees with your friends and find out, you know, what they might need, too. You may be able to provide assistance and check on them. Involve your whole network. Now, we all live complicated lives. We've got personal lives and work lives. But your network includes your caregivers, if you happen to use any, like Richard and I do, your family members, your distant relatives, because that's who's going to be checking on you when they don't hear anything, your friends and your peers, or both, if they happen to be the same, your coworkers. The office situation is where a lot of us spend our time during the day, and our coworkers should know how to help us out in an emergency. Our neighbors. How many of you know all the neighbors on three sides of your house, plus somebody across the street? Okay, I see two hands go up, and mine isn't up because I don't know all those neighbors yet either. Well, in a disaster, you may need any or all of them to help you out, and there may not be everybody home. So get to know your neighbors a little bit and talk about this seriously, especially if you're like me and you live in goldfish territory. The first responders. Have you stopped by your local fire department? I mean, most of us have a station somewhere within a couple of 3 miles of our house. Stop by and introduce yourself. So, you know, I live over on Zephyr Cove Circle, and, you know, if there's a real big flood coming and you don't see my van leaving the driveway, would you stop by and beat on my door and break in the glass window and pull me out of bed? So, I mean, you can ask for those kind of things, and they'll be a little more aware of your situation. And, of course, the paratransit and the other people you work with on a daily basis on your emergency or human services issues. You all need to become experts. When you leave this room, you're going to have enough resources to make yourself an expert. I don't consider myself an expert. I work on this issue at the federal level and the state level, and I've done a lot of local trainings, but I'm still not an expert. I learn something from every audience, and every day I learn something more. But know the issues surrounding emergency preparedness for not only you and your family, but your other peers with disabilities of all types. Study the appropriate responses and readiness for whatever situation might occur where you live. Become an example to your friends and neighbors. Go out and ask them if they're ready. Say, hey, I've got all this material here. Would you like to take a look at it? It may be applicable to you. And by all means, don't forget your pets. So I know you won't. And I say pets and service animals. That's kind of my consolidation for this presentation. And I'm going to have the United Animal Nation information is in this packet I've got available in my handout. So you will have access to all that. And Anne Marie's smiling because she's going to have it as well. Mitch is probably going to bring it up. So like I said, we don't invent this. We sometimes use it. At home, prepare an emergency escape plan. We've talked about that. You need to practice that plan with your family and your caregivers. They need to know what their role might be in an emergency. Designate an outside meeting place. If there's an emergency in your home, like a fire or a flood, the first thing you need to think about is escape. Where are you going to do it? And then identify where you're going to get together or who you're going to contact. If you need to call somebody, think of a distant relative that'll be out there where the phones are still working and the power is still on, that everybody in your household can contact afterwards to check in. I'm going to talk a little bit about personal emergency supplies. This doesn't just apply to those who have vision loss. This applies to all of us. It's pretty much out there. There's checklists available. A lot of this information has been consolidated off of three or four different checklists. You know, you need a gallon of water a day. You can just use tap water, put a little bleach in it. I think it's, what, 9 drops a gallon? Something like that, Anne-Marie? Something like that. Enough to kill all the bugs in it, but still make it tasty. You know, other people may need more water. If you got children, they may drink more. Nursing mothers, sick people who are ill. If you live in a Palm Springs in the summertime and you have power outages or you have to stay at home for a while, you might need even more than we do in Northern California. Make sure it's stored and clean, and each person should have at least a 3-day supply of water. In my garage, I've got, I don't know if any of you have cats, but my sister buys this cat litter from Costco in these big 3-gallon jugs. Those are cleaned up, and they're storing water in my garage. I don't try to think about where they came from, but it was clean kitty litter, she advises me. So that's what we have to do. If you live in the mountains, I used to live up in Washington State where there's storms coming all the time. The last 45 days I lived in Washington State, which is part of why I moved to California, we were without power for 22 days. I had power in my office, but I'd come home at night to no power. So I'd stop at the deli, get food, and in the morning I had gas water so I could have a hot shower, which is all I cared about. And I would charge my wheelchair and my cell phone at work. But up there, portable generators and fuel, and if you lived up around Mount Shasta here or some of these mountain areas, everybody should have that, and they're not that expensive. A propane stove. We had to do a lot of cooking on propane, and it helps to have it available. Sleeping bags and blankets. I can tell you I had about 3 sleeping bags on top of my bed every night because I had no heat in my house. But even around here in the summertime, you're going to need something to protect yourself if you have to stay home overnight. Flashlights. Now, I brought some samples of some stuff that's available. I'm not going to give these away. These are my personal supply, but I scrounged around my house. There's flashlights that you can wind up, and they're pretty cool. They got a halogen light. They're very bright. They last a long time. They've got these new ones that you can shake, and if you and I'll let you look at these afterwards, but you can just buy these things for $5 a piece, and that's where I got mine, on the drugstore shelf by the checkout stand at a Walgreens. And you shake them, they don't need a battery, you just shake them back and forth and they have a lot of light. Now, if you don't need a flashlight to find your way around your house, that's one thing. But if you got a signal for help, or you might have family members or caregivers there that could use a little light in an emergency, it's a great thing to have. Lanterns, I've got about 3 battery operated and a Coleman lantern in my garage that I can pull out in an emergency. Of course, I think my batteries are dead by now, but you should keep those up too. And I've got a portable radio here that you can hand crank, and it'll last for a couple hours. So I can listen to the Kings if the radio station's still playing during the power outages. And they're cheap. They're not expensive. I think the radio costs about $20 at Costco, and the flashlights, like I said, are as low as $5 a piece. other things we need, food. I brought with me, and Anne-Marie, can I talk? You just kind of stand it up. For about $55, you can go on the American Red Cross website, and I've got a red backpack here with a big red cross on. I'm not advertising them right now, but this was an easy way for me to put together a kit that'll last me for about 3 days, and there's dried food in there. There's some water. You know, it's like being in the Army again. Everything's freeze-dried and condensed, but it's very handy to have around. It takes some of the pressure off. If you're storing your own, take foods that require little or no refrigeration or preparation or no water to make it happen. Be sure you got a can opener if you got cans, you know, it's and some eating utensils if you don't want to do the finger thing. Choose foods your family will eat. If you've got some finicky eaters, like say Richard was in your family, you'd want to have Pepsi and a hamburger. So, but you know, you've got ready-to-eat canned meats and fruits and vegetables that are pretty easily available. These protein and fruit bars and granola bars are everywhere. Even dry cereal, if you don't have milk, it's still pretty edible and good for you. Peanut butter. Who could go for 3 days without peanut butter? I couldn't. You know, some dried fruit and nuts and crackers and juices, the things that aren't going to spoil. And you can buy that non-perishable pasteurized milk that you can keep on the shelves for a couple centuries. You know, they're going to dig us up and put the milk on their cereal 200 years from now. So that stuff is available. And some high-energy foods, those protein bars, something to keep you awake and alert and ready to get out of there when you can. A lot of us need our vitamins every day and, of course, some comfort and stress foods, which I consider peanut butter to be, but, you know, you may have something else you like better. A lot of first aid supplies. I'm not going to go through this whole list, but there's things that you're going to need. If you normally use an antibiotic lotion on some part of your body, if you have an eye drops or ointments you need, you should have those and consider them to be just as important as prescription medication. There's a need going to be need for bandages and adhesive wraps and tape and those type of things if there's any kind of a violent situation like an earthquake or a fire. So be prepared with all those. And like I said, that list is available in your handout and on those CDs. There's some things that are pretty handy to have. I was unfortunate enough to be in Florida in 2004 when Hurricane Charley came through. That was one of those five hurricanes that hit the state. And I was staying with my brother. And the wind, when it came through, there was only 95 miles an hour. But it tore the hell out of everything. And, I mean, there were trees down everywhere. The power was out for 3 days. No phones. Nobody could get down the roads. The gas stations and the grocery stores were all closed. And I found what it was like to be unprepared in a disaster. Now, Florida does this every year, two or three or four times. So when they have a disaster, they see it coming over in the Atlantic, and they move people across the state. They'll evacuate the whole side of the state. That ain't going to happen in California, folks. We're going to have to be ready. There they go into these shelters, and they have special needs shelters, so all of us could be together and play gin rummy or whatever we wanted. But we have a lot of those older folks there with us, too. But, you know, we're not going to have that happen in California. We need to be better prepared. So remember your cell phones. And I've got to tell you from experience, you know, there's two things that go wrong when the power goes out. First, the cell phone towers don't work. And then you can't recharge your dang cell phone. So you've got to be able to think about those in advance. There's things like laxatives if you're not eating right. And looking at what's in this pack, I might need one. But also, you might have to have some antacids if you eat some of that other stuff on that list. If you've got a vision impairment, you know, I think it makes really common sense. And some of this stuff you won't have to be told. But if you've got extra canes, you probably want to store those in the room. I see most of the people in here have the folding type, which I expected, but it's important that you have an extra cane around. You may not be able to find it. It may wash out of your house with the flood water, or it may get burned up. And so keep an extra one in a backpack or in your garage or someplace you can grab it. Put some alternative lighting and emergency cues in your room so that you can find your way down the hall if you have some low vision and you need light. They have these stick-on lights that you can buy at, you know, they're called bed lamps or closet lights. Some of them turn off automatically after 5 minutes. I actually keep one on my bed because I can roll over and hit that in the night and see which channel I want to put my TV control on. But you can stick them on your walls and put them in your closets. label all your emergency styles, supplies any way you need it, whether it's with Braille tape or fluorescent tape or just some large print tape, something that you can see, you can find, and you can identify. I've already mentioned your data. How many of you think about backing up your computer files? How many of you do it regularly? I mean, real regularly, like maybe once every 2 weeks? Somebody does. Thank you. We have one good example in the room, and I'm a bad example on that. Do you have your emergency numbers as well as your family and friends pre-programmed in your phones? You know, you may want your doctor number, you may want 911, and you may want the hospital programmed in there as well. Absolutely. I love to hear that. Waterproof. There's also fireproof containers that are waterproof you can store your valuables in. You know, besides making copies of your identification cards and your insurance papers, give that copy to somebody in your family you trust, if you have somebody you can trust in your family. Have somebody, if you can't do it yourself, go around your house with a digital camera and take pictures of all your artwork, your television, your radio, your stereo, or whatever else you consider valuable. And if you have a way to do it, record the serial numbers off those items. One of the items that can happen, one of the things that can happen under disasters is come home and find out somebody's had a moving van in your driveway all day. So you may be able to get some of that stuff back. And if they have a picture of it, it's better. Store your family photo albums in large tubs, you know, like Rubbermaid things you can buy at Costco or Target. And make sure that they're dry if your garage floods or if your bookshelves flood, rather than keeping them on the bookshelf and pulling them off there. As from the United Animal Nation, we have some of the stuff that they recommend too. Take several pictures of your animals, all kinds of poses, and make sure they're in there with your insurance papers and other important documents. See if your veterinarian happens to have a pet-friendly or animal-friendly emergency preparedness plan. They may have some more recommendations for your schnauzer that other people don't. Also, if you've got long-term medications for your pets and your service animals, make sure you keep them with your prescription drugs, your extra supply that you're going to get from Medicare now that will be available to you to take with you. And actually, my sister's got a cat that's got diabetes and gets insulin shots 3 times a day. So, well, no, I'm sorry. I'd say the same thing. But she has to give those shots, and if she had to evacuate an emergency and didn't have it, the cat would be in stress. So make sure that when there is a disaster or something approaching, your animal knows it's going to happen as well. And they need a lot of comfort, just like I do in an emergency, so be sure you provide that comfort. I'm not going to go through all the animal stuff here, but we know that when you're storing your food, you're going to store pet food the same way. You're going to keep it waterproof. They recommend in an emergency you increase the ratio of dry food to the wet food if you've been giving it, just because it's easier on the animal and may prevent accidents. Be sure you have places where you can take your animal with you, your animals with you when you evacuate. If you've got a friend who won't allow a dog in their house, that's probably not where you want to go in a disaster. That type of thing. You do need to take things with you in a disaster. You need to be prepared to, even if you get stuck at home. And this is my portable kit, as those of you who could see it will note. It's in a red backpack. It's easy to identify. It's in my hallway closet, so I can go out the door with it. If I was really prepared, I'd have 10 days worth of medication in there as well. And I'd rotate that medication once in a while so it wasn't outdated. My battery-powered radio and my flashlight would be in there as well. And you need to figure out that you may have to signal for some help. You saw people on the roofs in New Orleans. You know, after a while, they got tired of yelling. It would have been very helpful if they had a whistle. If they saw a boat going up another street, they could have had somebody come over there. You're going to need some bright-colored items. Fortunately, I've got a red backpack. Those flashlights can come in handy for that as well. If you're trapped in a situation in a house or it's night, you can signal people that you're there. A lot of these little things I'm not going to have time to go through. Those checklists are all there. You know, we still have a lot of work that lies ahead, and Richard and I were talking this morning about how we really need to get this state to recognize the vulnerable populations. And we've done a lot of work. There's a greater awareness today than there was 3 or 4 years ago. You know, we all look back on 2001 as being kind of the landmark date for turning people around to the needs of vulnerable populations. And yet we still have major disasters every year across the nation, from house fires to group homes and nursing homes that have disasters to major cities. And we have to be better prepared. The disability community knows what's best for the disability community. No matter what we come down to, that is where the knowledge lies. We need to be prominent players in the emergency response infrastructure. We've got notification and recovery and evacuation recommendations that have been developed that are readily available, that are in your handout, that can be given to every local and regional and statewide emergency service agency that will serve you well. You need to be at the table to make sure that they get those recommendations, they understand them, and that they put them into effect whenever there's a disaster. Your transit agencies need to be a key player. How many of you rely on public transportation as your main transportation option? A lot of hands go up in this room, and you know, you need to be there. When somebody says regional transit or MTA is having a public hearing about new routing or new hours of services or rates of pay, you need to be there. Carol Bradley is in the room today, the ADA coordinator for the city of Sacramento, and she's been putting notices out about transportation hearings and infrastructure hearings going on in the Sacramento region. You, if you live in Sacramento, need to be there, and they're occurring in every city in the state right now. We need to also be on top of the shelter situation. You know, nobody thinks about sheltering until there's a disaster. But believe me, they have plans in place in your local community for every school they're going to use, every community hall, every fire station, and every other large structures, maybe state office buildings, where they're going to move people to in an emergency. You need to be there and say, okay, how accessible is this? Have you checked the restrooms? Are there emergency supplies maintained in that location? And are you going to be able to provide services to vulnerable people? People who need caregivers, people who need interpreters, people who have service animals. And if they answer no to any of those, you need to get the answer turned around so it's yes. And you're going to hear that multiple times. I have about 5 pages of resources available in that handout or on that CD you picked up. And I'll encourage you to go to those. They're all internet-based. And if you don't use the internet, you can go through it with a friend, and I'm sure they'd find it very interesting as well, because a lot of these recommendations apply to everybody. I would encourage you to do that when you get home, so this subject is still on the top of your list. And I would encourage you to become an advocate, to go out, become a missionary for emergency preparedness, talk to your friends, talk to your families, talk to everybody here, and make sure that when they go home, they start thinking about the same thing. With that, my address, my business cards are on the back table, my address and my phone number and my email are on this handout you have. Many of you know me. Many of you are on my list. And if you want to be on my email notification list for issues that have to do with vision loss, just let me know what your address is. Send me an email, and I'll add you to it. Are there any immediate questions that can't wait till after Mitch and Anne-Marie get done? Yes, lady in the first row. Yeah, could you please? Oh, I'm Mike Collins. I'm the executive director of the State Independent Living Council, for those of you that came in. So I apologize for that.
And your email?
Well, if you're writing down or typing in my email, it's M. Collins, M-C-O-L-L-I-N-S, at CalSilk, C-A-L, S like in Sam, I-L-C, .org, O-R-G. And we are a small state agency located here in Sacramento. Okay, I'm going to answer a question here in the front row. Thank you for your patience. Yes, you.
Okay, cool. I'm involved with involved in this in Mendocino County, and two things we stress you haven't mentioned. One of them is most all of us have a portable phone in our house, maybe by your bedside or something you can take out to a laundry room. Those do not work without electricity.
Good point.
Very important to know, nor will your computer. So you really need to have something, you know, to back you up, maybe in print or whatever, but I think that that's extremely important for people to understand. I have a friend I'm rather close with who argued with me about the portable phone thing, and so he said, well, I'll just show you. I'm going to, you know, put it on the wall, and it'll work. Well,
it doesn't work.
Right. It does not work.
I'll repeat that. For those of you that couldn't hear it, the lady says that, remember that the portable phones you have, the ones you can take outside, the cordless phones around the house, they don't work when the power's out. And if you don't believe it, go home and unplug it and try it. And also your computers don't. Now, if you have a laptop, you've got a couple of hours that you can use, but if you have a regular computer and the power is off, that doesn't work either. Are there any other pressing questions? And the lady that asked my address, go ahead.
How do we find out where the location of the shelters is? That in your handout?
Well, every city is different. If you want to find out where your nearest shelter is, call your local fire department. Call your local police department. Not on 911. Don't use that number. Call their local number and ask them, where are we going to go in an emergency? What is my nearest shelter? And are you ready to accommodate me and my service animal? In the back row, the gentleman, yes, with your hand up right now.
Not necessarily true.
And I'm going to repeat this. So, yes, are we doing coordination with senior citizen centers? Yes, people who go to senior centers are usually over 60 or 65 years of age. We work very closely with the senior population in California. In fact, you have an opportunity to hear more about this, and in April 25th, 6th, and 7th, down in Concord, we have an event called the Coordinated Leadership Conference, and this is a meeting of the advocates for both the senior community and the disability community statewide, and it's a fairly reasonably priced conference. Emergency preparedness is on our agenda. Transportation is our number one issue for people with disabilities and seniors, so if you've got an interest in transportation or emergency preparedness, please look for that conference. And you can get the information about it from C4A.org. Very simple to remember. C4A.org, off their website. Many of the key players that are going to be at that conference are in this room and at this conference. So we hope to see you there. Yes, in the second row, gentleman with the part that looks so good on his hair. That's you.
Excuse me.
That's fine.
Is your handout Braille-like?
I don't have it in Braille. I have it in a CD, but if you need a Braille copy of it, it's a PowerPoint presentation, and we can get that. So. Okay, well, if you notify the lady in the back of the room before she gets out of here afterwards and give her your address. Pam, you still here? Pam Porteous is our analyst at the State Independent Living Council, and she actually does our embossing, and so you can contact her, and she'll be there looking for you. Okay. Next to you, you have a young lady that's got her hands up.
Yeah, I came in after you handed out the materials. Was there stuff like this? Yeah.
There are still CDs. I see about 30 of them on the back table, and there's handouts in large print and regular print. So we're about out of time, so I'm going to ask you to hold your questions for Mitch or Anne-Marie and or afterwards for all three of us. And I thank you very much. Contact me or talk to me afterwards if you have more questions. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you, Mike. Our next speaker is Anne-Marie Jones, the Executive Director of the Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. She'll talk about her agency, which is an organization that works with community service groups, government, local government, in disaster preparedness, response, and recovery activities at local level. She has numerous groups that she's members of, some that she does chair, for instance, the Oakland Emergency Management Board,
the Alameda County BioTerrace Council, many others. She's received numerous awards, most recently the 2005 Women Who Dare Award from Girls Inc., which is a national organization that helps girls to become stronger, smarter, and bold in activities. She's a passionate advocate who has worked in this area as an advocate, but as a paid person in the areas of the American Red Cross, working with the Governor's Office of Emergency Services in the Pacific region, and she'll tell more about her background, and let's welcome her.
Good morning. I am delighted to be here, and I'm Anna Marie Jones, and I'm the Executive Director of CARD. And before I actually get into my presentation, I wanted to address, a couple of things just so that there's no miscommunication. I'm not actually the chair of all of the groups that Jean mentioned. I do serve on all of those groups, but I didn't want any government official thinking that I'm presenting myself as the chair of their group. One of the reasons I am absolutely delighted to be here is that my organization has focused on people with disabilities and special needs since our creation. And I'll tell you more about CARD, but I want to put on the table right away what makes me one of your more controversial speakers. Before I got in the world of disaster preparedness with the Loma Prieta earthquake, I spent the first 10 years of my life in advertising and marketing research in New York City. And what I would tell you about the entire topic of disaster preparedness is that it is the most poorly marketed and misunderstood topic that I can think of. And I will cover more about that, but I wanted to let you know. And I just wanted to just put that out there right from the beginning, that what I hope to do with my time with you this morning is to give you a complete shift of consciousness about the topic, as well as give you a different way that we could look at this as a community for moving forward. And probably the best way to describe why I believe preparedness is mismarketed is because even the title, it's emergency preparedness or disaster preparedness, and the truth is it has nothing to do with the disasters. It has everything to do with you, your family, your community, whatever your commitments are. It is all about you. And I'll tell you that one of the reasons we named this presentation the prosperity approach is because if we looked at this topic not as, oh, disaster preparedness, the thing we have to do because horrible things are going to happen, but we looked at it as these are the things we can do that will build our capacity to be strong, to be resilient, to be a self-helping, self-healing, self-nurturing community, we would be a prospering community. So is everybody clear that, first off, from this point forward, let's not look at this as a disaster conversation or a preparedness conversation. It's a you conversation. It's an empowerment and strength-building conversation. I'll tell you a little bit about CARD. The 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake interrupted the World Series, right? And when you interrupt the World Series, when it's happening in your backyard, you get something that is remarkable, and I mean absolutely remarkable, and that is every single solitary elected official, every single politician, they do what we call the Scarlett O'Hara moment. The Scarlett O'Hara moment is when they stand up in front of you with all the cameras clicking away, and they say things like this. They say, "As God is my witness, we will never be unprepared again." And they promise you things, and we talk about planning, and it's all good, right? And the truth of the matter is, these are the same people that had never, ever uttered the words preparedness before. They had never spoken about vulnerable population preparedness before. And it falls off the agenda just about as quickly as the cameras close down. And the reason we know this is because we were, you know, my office is in downtown Oakland. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Northern California Bay Area, we are lovingly known around the world as America's Act of God theme park. earthquakes, fires, floods, hazardous materials spills. Heck, we mobilize our Office of Emergency Services if our sports teams win or lose. So we've got some experience in it, and the truth is that when the Loma Prieta earthquake happened, we had long known we were at risk for earthquakes. We had long known how diverse our communities are, but we were dismally unprepared. And what I would say is, I spent many years working for the American Red Cross and being a volunteer. Volunteer leadership with them, as well as I spent many years working for the California Office of Emergency Services. So there is no part of this presentation that is coming to you from the perspective of they are completely right, or they are completely wrong, or they are completely good, or they are completely bad. The entirety of this conversation is based on what can we do as a community to ensure that everyone in the community prospers and moves forward. And what we saw was that all of those organizations, Red Cross, government, FEMA, all of them, along with all of the brilliant, heroic things that happened, they were unable to address vulnerable populations. Truly, if you couldn't get to the shelter on your own, there were no other options. If you could not live in a public shelter, for whatever reason, there were no other options. And everything we experienced with Hurricane Katrina, every single thing, we already knew it was going to happen. Okay, we had had the Loma Prieta earthquake. We saw this breakdown long ago. And by the way, the Loma Prieta earthquake wasn't even the first earthquake to put vulnerable populations on the map. Going all the way back to Hurricane Camille, years and years before that, we saw vulnerable populations, seniors, people with disabilities, non-English speakers, they had no resources. The difference was, as I mentioned earlier, is that Loma Prieta captured international news media because of the World Series. We had also, 2 years, almost to the day after the Loma Prieta earthquake, the Oakland Hills firestorm. Now, how much do you think had changed for seniors, people with disabilities, and non-English speakers in the 2 years?
I lived there. Nothing.
Okay, the reason we don't say that it was completely nothing is because there were tons more brochures. Okay? At my office, we call brochures the magic beans of preparedness, because that is what is handed out. Generic courses and now generic websites and brochures, right?
Covers the holes in the wall.
Exactly. And the truth is, whether or not they put them in Braille in large print, because most of the time it's an afterthought and it's something that has to be pressed, you'll notice that you're not prepared even when you have the brochure in Braille or large print, because all you're getting, in truth, is the Braille or large print version of the thing that didn't work to prepare the people it was originally created for. Okay, let's be very, very honest about this conversation. It's not that vulnerable populations are unprepared. It's that as a nation we are unprepared, and vulnerable people just have greater issues to face. So when we take something like a brochure and translate it into multiple languages, put it in Braille, put it in large size font, all we have accomplished is giving you equal access to the information that didn't exactly hit the mark the first time. Can everybody see that? Thank you.
Yeah.
It is part of the reason why we took a very different approach with CARD. It was actually the United Way of the Bay Area that stood up and said, whoa, wait a minute. Why is it that the same people are always the first victims in disasters? It's always seniors, it's always people with disabilities, it's always poor people. Why exactly is that? So what they did, which I still consider to be one of the most remarkable community meetings I've ever experienced, was they brought hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of community leaders together. These are people who are the executive directors and the management staff for agencies that serve the disabled, agencies that serve low-income people, organizations that focus on immigrants' rights. And and faith-based organizations, hundreds of them in a room, and they asked them these questions. They asked, okay, we had the Loma Prieta earthquake. Everybody was talking about preparedness. You know, money was given out here. Everybody get a plan here. Have a brochure. Get a plan. Go, go, go. Why was it that you were still so unprepared? And this is what's really important. Some people said, well, you know, after a disaster, you just don't want to think about this anymore. You want to go back to normal. We had had enough trauma. We just didn't do it. Perfectly reasonable, yes?
For me.
Understandable, but not acceptable.
Excellent response. Who said that?
Me.
Very good. But here's what other people said. Some people were absolutely unwilling to participate in preparedness activities after the fact because they didn't want to participate with government or with Red Cross.
I give up.
Now, anybody here want to guess just some of the reasons why people were not interested and jumping for joy at the idea of working with government and Red Cross?
A trust issue.
I hear the words trust and bureaucracy over and over and over. Yes, trust and bureaucracy were huge, but I can tell you that one of the other reasons that came up over and over and over, and it is still present to this day, is that some people held some really intimate personal upsets with both government and the Red Cross. And one of the most inflamed issues was a very simple one, and you'll all understand it the minute I say it. Animals. The agencies that served seniors and people with disabilities were very, very clear that the fact that government and Red Cross did not understand the incredible bond between people with disabilities and their service animals and pets was absolutely unacceptable. And to this day, with Hurricane Katrina, we saw this, people had to make some of the most horrifying choices in their lives, where they had a choice of being safe or having their animal. They didn't have the choice of having both. Okay, now really let that soak in, that that is where we are, and this disaster just happened. We have had this issue forever, and we have not powerfully addressed it. And I'll go into some of the reasons why, but that was one of the issues that came up. Why would you want to work with agencies that were so unclear as to your needs, your values, and the things that would make your life work? They didn't understand not just the emotional connection, but the security, the protection, the utility, the partnership. You guys understand that. You guys don't question that. But the fact that after all of these disasters, we couldn't get our major organizations that are charged with this to address it was unacceptable. But here's the biggest thing that came out of those conversations. What they said was, we did try to prepare. We did. We took the brochures, we took the pamphlets, we took the binders, we took the planning guidance. And you know what? It didn't come with a little check inside. It didn't come with an emergency manager inside. Therefore, you were basically giving all of this information to an agency that didn't have the background in this. It was not their discipline. And they were just told, go forth, you know, be ready now. It didn't work. So CARD was literally created because community-based organizations who serve vulnerable populations needed a safe, trusted, local resource that was responsive to their needs to help them in the preparedness process, whether that's having a disaster plan in place, whether it was offering preparedness classes to their vulnerable populations, just whatever types of conversations those community agencies needed so that they could move forward powerfully. The chances that people with disabilities and the extremely poor were going to just someday decide, hey, let me check out that Red Cross website, or hey, let me go to ready.gov and take on... It's not going to happen. It's still not going to happen. So that is, in essence, why we were created. And we serve those organizations, and we are not a compliance agency. An agency doesn't have to worry that if they talk to us, there is some problem that's going to happen. You know, they will not be fined. They're not going to get dinged. They're not going to get in trouble because they didn't have a plan. We are there in service to them. Why, thank you. I want to tell you some of the greatest threats facing blind and visually impaired communities. At the top of my list, I would tell you that because preparedness is not understood, one of your greatest threats is that you are constantly, and I do mean constantly, surrounded by people who are entirely clueless and don't know what to do. Can everybody see why that is a clear and present danger? Awesome. The fact that special needs preparedness is so dismally understood makes that even harder. It means that the people around you, not only are they unprepared, they don't have a clue as to what it means to be in your shoes. They don't understand some of the most basic issues, and therefore, even when they're trying to help, they don't understand what that means. I would believe that we could change this entire conversation if we change just a few policies that are in our community. And one of them is that when we do talk about preparedness, we talk about deliverables and we fund deliverables for the community, but not in the community. For example, you could have the government or Red Cross, they will get money, grants, whatever, and they'll create X number of brochures. And so a successful deliverable for them will be, we have distributed 50,000 brochures. Right? That's a deliverable for the community from some other organization. Does that translate into specific measurable preparedness in the community? I'm going to repeat that one more time, because if anybody leaves this room not crystal clear on this one, I will not have done my job. We fund agencies to create deliverables for people with disabilities, but we do not fund deliverables that are specific and measurable in the community. Does everybody have that? Is there any, please raise your hand if that was not crystal clear, because I'm going to keep saying it and we're not going on until we all get it. Awesome. I would tell you that even advocates for disabled communities continue to fight a battle that actually isn't going to get you what you want. Many, many advocates will spend their time hammering and hammering to do things like, oh, let's get those brochures in large font and let's get them in Braille, when what we really, really should be hammering on is getting the information that will actually make the difference. Okay, can everybody get that one? Great. I've also seen advocates spend a lot of time trying to beat, say, the Red Cross or government into being all things to all people. I want to just put out there the different paradigm. If you spent your time saying, okay, let them be good at what they're good at, and fund disability organizations to be good at what they're good at, what would your life be like if every organization you worked with, oh, we've got Mike over here. What if Mike's organization were actually well-funded to have disaster preparedness in a culturally appropriate way distributed? Would that be a little better than the generic brochures that have never yet gotten you prepared?
No.
So understand that that is our policy. Our policy is to fund disaster response agencies to do emergency preparedness when they are mass care, mass population focused, but then we expect that suddenly they're able to do something meaningful for special populations. This does not happen anywhere in life. If we try to look at this model from a completely different topic, it would seem ridiculous. McDonald's. Anybody here ever eaten in McDonald's? Please raise your hand if you've eaten in McDonald's. Okay. Now, McDonald's is an incredibly successful business, right? They can put up a McDonald's almost anywhere in the world and know that it's going to make money and be successful. And bear in mind, this does not have any relationship to whether you like McDonald's, whether you think McDonald's is a good idea. We're just looking at the model, okay? Would it be reasonable to say, okay, McDonald's is now going to serve vulnerable people special dietary meals? Okay, but you're going to use the same delivery method. You know, you're going to have McDonald's stores, and you're going to use the same vendors and same products and same everything, but only we're going to call it special needs food. Would that make sense? Would it be wise? No, but somehow this is what we do with disaster response agencies. We think disaster response agencies are just miraculously also vulnerable population preparedness agencies. They're not, and they're not going to be. It's that physics law that form follows function. Any agency that is created to be responsive to emergencies, mobilized for mass care, that's who they attract, it's who they hire, it's how they're structured to perform. And then we're shocked, absolutely shocked, that in every disaster, they are unable to do what you need at the level of individuals with special needs. Would you go to McDonald's if you knew you had special dietary requirements?
No.
So think about what we have done as a nation. We have decided that vulnerable population preparedness is so easy to master that you could just have any generic organization putting out brochures and doing these things. And that's not to downplay the great things that are being done. But the mass care function is about mass care. It is about mass sheltering. And I don't know how much you spent in terms of time with the Hurricane Katrina coverage, but the truth is that was a hard environment for anyone to survive. I mean, I am strong, I am healthy, I don't have any vision issues other than the fact that without my contacts I can't see anything. But the truth is, that shelter environment would have been hard on me. It would have been hard on anyone. And look at the people who were in the shelter. You had your most fragile, you had your sick, you had people who had life issues that already made them vulnerable, and that was the only option for them. So the people who were least able to navigate that experience, that was all that was in place for them. Why? Because that's what we fund. And be very clear that we fund that over and over. We fund it for, as government. We fund it as individuals. When we say, every time there's a disaster, what does the U.S. government do? They get on the development team for the American Red Cross because they're chartered by Congress to provide mass care. So there's a huge push to send all your money. They open up shelters, and that's what we have. And I'm not saying that the shelters don't serve a valuable function. Obviously, we need that capacity to set up shelters. But the fact that all of the money, it's a sole source, multi-billion dollar push to one agency that has never had the capacity to be the type of service provider that you need in crisis. That is one of the key reasons why we have the issues we have. Can everybody see that? All the money being pushed towards disaster response for mass care, not preparedness special care. Huge distinction. And if your community-based organizations that you rely on for service had that level of funding, support, and buy-in, you'd see a distinct difference. The curriculum we have, if I were able to share that with Mike's organization and Mike were funded to be able to make that difference, you'd see a noticeable, measurable difference in the preparedness levels for every person with a disability. Does anybody here disagree with that? Awesome. One of the things I want to share is also about marketing. I mentioned that my background is marketing. And every single message you have ever heard about preparedness is based in fear. It is based in, you should do this because terrible, terrible things are going to happen, right? Earthquakes, fires, floods, they hate us for our freedom, terrorism, right? In marketing, you never use fear to sell a product unless your product is the 100% solution for the issue. Okay? So if I'm trying to sell, say, dandruff shampoo, right? Dandruff shampoo is sold pretty much the same way all the time. They show the person being unhappy with the white flakes on their shoulder, right? A little embarrassed. They're thumping the flakes off. And they want to be attractive. And then there's the image of the shampoo, right? Uh-huh. And after, yeah, like Selsun Blue or, you know, Head and Shoulders, whatever it is, then you see images of the person with beautiful hair and no flakes on their shoulder. And they're happy, 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 right? So it makes perfect sense to use a little bit of fear that, hey, you're going to have dandruff. Because the shampoo can be the 100% solution. With disasters, what we do is rather bizarre. We tell you terrible things are going to happen, things you personally can't control. We can't even predict it. Okay? And by the way, you should just be aware that, you know, people hate us, and any time they could wipe us off the face of the earth. But the thing that's going to make the difference is a bag of tuna and some water and, right? Which, it gives people a whole lot of permission to think that, you know, we're screwed, you know? Is that not true? Every single product you have ever purchased, I promise you, they tapped into something you either wanted or needed or desired. Okay, when they're selling cars, they sell cars completely based on things like, you're going to be hot in that car, okay? Toothpaste. Every single toothpaste is about giving you a sexy smile and pretty breath and, you know, it's all good. They don't try to make you feel bad and ugly and scared, okay? They don't. Why? You want positive association with your product. Companies spend millions of dollars, and I do mean millions of dollars, to make you think well of them. Not only with their product, but they give you stuff, right? You go to a conference, and they're handing out foam fingers and hats and mugs and giveaways because they want you to feel very happy and positive about them. Now, think of what we do with disasters. What we do with disaster education is we tell you that things way beyond your control are going to happen to you. There are people who are responders, police, fire, Homeland Security, Red Cross, FEMA, but not you. But not you. You're not the responders, right? You're not. And the thing you should do is just get a little stuff and hope for the best, basically, and hope for the responders to rescue you. Amen. The mindset right there is enough to wipe out your community. From this moment forward, I want you to consider that you are emergency responders. You're only separated by your level of experience. That's the only thing that stops us from being emergency responders. Can everybody get that? You're probably sitting here. Some of you have no emergency preparedness training. All that means is that you are an untrained responder, but you're going to respond. So one of the most important messages that I heard from Mike was about being that level of advocate, taking the training and being aware, because you are a responder. And we should not be delusional about this. We've always known who the first victims in any disaster would be. It is always going to be those who are not going to be able to address those basic needs, whether it's because of a disability, whether it's because of money. I mean, look how many people from Hurricane Katrina had absolutely no option because they didn't have a car. The disaster struck at the end of the month before they were going to get their next check. So timing could make you that vulnerable. And the truth is, we need to get over sharing negativity. We need to get over giving all of the resources to what we consider to be the professional responders. And we need to be really focused on vulnerable population preparedness, because if the vulnerable populations are prepared, Who is prepared? Everyone is prepared. When we build a community where the most vulnerable in this room is safe and protected and able to survive and thrive and prosper, everybody else will be fine. Can everybody get that? That instead of building all of our systems to address, you know, kind of the Darwin mold of, you know, I mean, truly, it's very Darwinian the way it's done. It's survival of the fittest. The fact that the big thing is to create, you know, mass shelters and get your information off the internet, that's catering to the physically able, internet connected people who have the resources and ability to do all of those things. If we built it in the opposite manner, so that the most vulnerable have access, you know what? I'll be just fine, thank you. Can everybody get that? Awesome. I want to fast track you today on personal preparedness. You could leave this conference today absolutely more prepared, and I want to tell you a couple of things you could do. Number one, never, ever, ever leave home without a whistle and a flashlight. By a show of hands, be brutally honest, how many of you have with you right now a whistle? Okay, we have two hands up out of like 30 some odd hands in the room. How many of you have a flashlight with you? We have four, five, six hands. Excellent.
I got three.
Awesome. And the truth is, you can get the teeny tiny models. What I'm holding in my hand right now, I have a whistle that's way smaller than my pinky finger. I have a teeny tiny LED flashlight that's super, super bright and smaller than my thumbprint.
Can't see it.
I know. That's why I'm describing it. And I will be around so that everybody can come and see exactly how tiny it is and what it would mean if you were walking this world always, always, always with your own alerting and warning system.
Where'd you get them?
Oh, excellent question. I got the whistle and this little itty-bitty flashlight in Walgreens. Now, here's a trick question for you. Do you care whose logo is on the flashlight that saves your life? Awesome. So in the prosperity approach, one of the things you're doing is making sure that any vendor, any corporation, any group that wants to serve you, one of the ways that you can make this a mutually beneficial arrangement is ask them, instead of foam fingers and hats and mugs, ask them to slap their logo all over safety supplies and give it to you.
As long as it works, who cares?
I could care less whose logo is on the stuff that saves my life. I really couldn't care less. I would be happy to do it.
What do you tell the flashlight for the blind?
Ah, awesome question. This is something we have come up all the time. For example, in deaf audiences, they'll often say, but I can't hear the whistle. I don't care that you can't hear it. I care that other people can hear it and can save you. The same thing for having a flashlight. I don't actually care whether or not you can see it. The fact that I would be able to see you and that you would be a signaling beacon would make all the difference in the world. Can everybody get that? And this is something that, you know, some people frown upon me when I say this, but here's the ugly truth. If you're walking the world with the flashlight and you can't see it at all, it makes you a more valuable person to have around. It just does. You know, if you've got a radio with you, I could care less if you could hear it. The fact that you're the one with the radio suddenly makes you somebody they want to have with them. Can everybody see that? Sounds terrible. People pick on me when I say it, but the truth is you need to use every single tool at your disposal so that you are the best person in the world to save. Can you get that?
Yeah.
All righty. By a show of hands, how many of you have a computer that you use? Please raise your hands high. Awesome. Almost all of you. How many of you carry with you a computer jump drive, a teeny little disk that you can put your backups on? We see, let's see, it's a teeny tiny, okay, we've got six hands going up. The truth is, it's a teeny tiny little computer disk. It's literally smaller than my thumb. And you can put a tremendous amount of information on it. This little backup drive I have here has a half a gigabyte worth of space, which is more computer space than my first five computers held. And if you literally had your documents that were critical to you, your photos, your emergency contact information, your medical information, and all of those things with you, it would mean anywhere you are, you are ready to do whatever you need to do when a crisis happens.
Where would you carry that?
I carry it. I literally have a computer jump drive on my keychain. I have one in my purse. I mean, I am freakish about having preparedness things on me at all times, to the point where the necklace I wear, which is a teeny tiny little ball, again, smaller than the size of my thumb, is actually a preparedness piece of jewelry. Inside my necklace, there was a rolled up $100 bill. Yeah, my little weird hobby is figuring out how small I can roll up dollar bills.
Can I take you out when I see that? Go ahead, forget
it. The answer is yes. But here's the thing that happens with preparedness jewelry. One, it means that if I had to leave this building and I didn't have the opportunity to take my purse with me, if I had to crawl out on my belly, I would be outside with a $100 bill, a silver necklace, not caring whether the ATMs were down. When I show this in centers for people with disabilities and senior centers, we ask a question. And I'm going to ask it of you now. How many of you have ever, in your lifetime, received a gift for your birthday or for the holidays that you didn't like, you thought was ugly, and you were never going to use? Raise your hand high. Okay, almost every single hand went up. The next thing we do is we just facilitate a list of all of the different things you could ask for your birthday or for Christmas or for any gift-giving holiday that would leave you safer and more prepared. Whether it's whistles or flashlights or jump drives or digital cameras or Swiss Army knives, whatever it is, be the person that creates that wish list. It'll make the people in your life extremely happy because they don't really want to give you ugly things. They just don't know any better. And if you actually give them a list of things that you want, you need, and will make a difference in your life, you will be safer and they'll be happier. Yes, there's a question.
No, it's something that I did for Christmas for quite a few of my relations. There was this system, it had a flashlight, a whistle, and a knife.
Mm-hmm.
And it all in one, and it was, you know, compact. And I gave those to people for Christmas.
Awesome. And I'll tell you, I spend no time suffering over buying holiday gifts. Everybody in my life gets disaster geeky gifts. And I don't give it to them and tell them, terrible things are going to happen, you need to have this. I tell them how much I love them and how much I want them to walk this world safe. And all I'm doing is making sure that the people I love are taking incremental steps forward to be safe. Can everybody see the difference?
Amen.
Awesome.
How do you get the things to do anyway?
Awesome. Great question. For jewelry, I walk into every single jewelry store and I say, hi, could you show me what opens? And they will bring out lockets and prayer boxes and little, you know, cute balls like this and, you know, a variety of different tubes and cute little things with hidden compartments. And the deal is you could put anything you choose. I choose money often, but you could have emergency contact information on a piece of paper. You could put a dose of medication that is critical to you in that. I mean, there are lots and lots of ways to make it that you're walking this world a little more prepared. And
I think having cash and money available is very important to our group because during Katrina, many of my relatives who had ATMs, who had money in the bank, and when they had to get gas went up from $1.85 up to $10, $20 in only cash money. Mm-hmm. And so the thing of it is that it's important to do like the old song used to say, keep a dollar in your pocket.
Yep.
Because a dollar is your very best friend. And a lot of us, we believe in ATM, we believe in our plastic to the bank, but in time of a disaster, it's cash and carry.
That's right. And I'll tell you, some of the other solutions we've created with the communities we serve are incredibly simple, incredibly low cost, and I'm going to talk about it right now. How many of you have plastic bags at home, like Ziploc bags, like sealable sandwich bags? Aren't they a great invention? I'm like so happy they invented these things, but I'll tell you, the reason I am is because they are some of the greatest disaster tools in the world. In the world. If your only tool is a whole bunch of Ziploc bags, off the top of your head, just start guessing some of the things you would put in a Ziploc bag in an emergency.
Trail mix.
Excellent. Food. What else?
Medication.
Medication. What else?
Papers.
What else?
Money.
What else?
Dog food.
Excellent. What else?
Chocolate.
Excellent. Let me tell you, when we do that, we, in fact, because our trainings have to be appropriate for communities that have no money and people with different limitations, we do a lot of what I just did with you. We did the very short version here, but we do...
Question, please.
Sure.
What about scotch?
For some, that would be a disaster supply. But the truth is, when we do this exercise, we do it for several reasons. We could have gone on for many, many minutes and come up with hundreds of answers. I never put the list on a piece of paper and say, here are 5,000 things you can do with a Ziploc bag. Why? One, people would just read it and go, oh, that's nice, and never have the experience of thinking through it for themselves. And if you give people the opportunity to be creative and resourceful, they will be creative and resourceful. If you hand them information, they will do what people always do with information, which is to stack it, pile it, or throw it out. Is that not true? Awesome. I want to tell you a couple of the other things that happen when you do this exercise, and I encourage you to literally get Ziploc bags and do this exercise with your family. We normally do it as a speed round where you have 60 seconds and your job is to come up with every single solitary thing you could think of to do with a Ziploc bag. And what you will get at the end is not just how brilliant and creative your loved ones are, but you will see what matters to them. Because people come up with the answers that are very personal and significant to them. And in truth, if we actually had that situation where we have tons of Ziploc bags and we have just about nothing else, you'd still be able to do miraculous things. For example, my little itty-bitty flashlight, if I put it inside my Ziploc bag, suddenly I've got a little waterproof flashlight. If I have information and I put it inside that little Ziploc bag and I had to leave it on the door, then at least I've laminated it so that it'll stay there. When we do this exercise with like EMTs and medical people, they come up with tons and tons of medical things. They say things like, well, if you severed a finger, you put the finger in the bag, you put the bag on ice. Oh, Anna Marie, you could do a clean bullet wound extraction by taking this, that, and the other. If you put warm water in it, you could make it a warm compress. If you put ice cubes in it, you could make it a cold compress. And on and on and on with medical, medical, medical. When we do it with kids... They are brilliant, by the way. What do you think kids say is the thing they would use? Yep, they come up with food. What else?
Crayons
and toys. What else? You will find out exactly the things they value most. But the very best answer we've ever gotten from a child was, I could save my goldfish.
Oh.
Is that not a slice of brilliance? That came from a 6 or 7 year old boy who was crystal clear. That baggie is how the fish got in the house. That baggie is how the fish is getting out of the house. So I would encourage you to take on that exercise and for it to be one of the things you share, because you'll notice exactly how much laughter and good humor was in this room just in doing the exercise. And again, we want to take the fear and the threat out of preparedness and replace it with prosperity and love and team building. Can everybody see that? Awesome. Yeah, the goldfish is better than scotch. And by the way, we do this exercise with many different types of disaster supplies. We could just as easily have done this with duct tape. If you had a bunch of duct tape, what are 2 or 3 of the things you'd use duct tape for? You'd seal your windows. What else would you do with it? What else would you do with duct tape?
Bandage your wound.
Bandage a wound, absolutely.
Fix your glasses.
You could make clothing with duct tape. You could do any number of different things. My favorite answer related to duct tape came from the senior community, where a woman probably 75-ish years old said to me, and I can't do it nearly as well as she did it, but she said, "Honey, I could wax my legs with duct tape." I mean, is that not just a slice of brilliance?
That'd be a slice of hurt.
One of the things I highly recommend is that you do simple things like take a little Ziploc bag, put a light stick in it, a little itty-bitty whistle, a little itty-bitty flashlight, and then take a piece of paper, and whether you use large print or whether you use Braille, but make sure you have the things that in a crisis are going to be the things that you tend to forget. Under stress, people forget their first names. Make sure you have a really basic little short list of the things that are going to be important for you to remember. Little things like where to evacuate, where do you have your go kit. You might need a reminder of phone numbers. I mean, it could be really simple, but we're talking a one-page piece of paper. Again, either in large print or in Braille, whatever medium works for you. And then if you took that little baggie, which, by the way, has less than a dollar's worth of stuff in it, because I get my little flashlights oftentimes for free, because I ask companies for free stuff. That's less than a dollar's worth of stuff, but if you took that baggie and duct taped it under the table where you sit, or if you're a couch potato, put it down the cushion of the couch, what you'd have with you at all times is your alerting and warning system and a reminder of what's most important to you. Can everybody get the difference that would make? I want to show you a couple of the tools that we use, because I know no matter how simple or fun we make disaster preparedness, some people aren't going to take it on. We know that. But here's something we do know. Every single one of you between now and tomorrow at this time will use the restroom, yes? Anybody planning on not using the restroom in the next 24 hours? We thought so. So what we created was something called the Potty Poster Initiative. It's also known as the Captive Audience Program. It's based on the idea that people will indeed read and interact with whatever is in that bathroom with them. We know that because that's what humans do. So we have a potty poster that's all on whistle and flashlight skills, reminding you that 1 flash is yes, 2 is no, 3 is SOS. And just knowing that simple code would make all the difference in the world in terms of your ability to communicate. Can everybody get that? So if the inside bathroom stall door becomes a primary emergency preparedness training location, what you would know is when you go into a building to be touching the back of that door or looking for that thing in nice large font. Can everybody see the difference that would make if we had standardized information always in front of us in places that you know you're going to be? Much more effective than the Magic Bean brochure, don't you think?
Amen.
Excellent. I want to tell you, because I'm so glad you gave me time today.
Thank you.
A Sharpie marker. One of the things that we carry a lot in CARD are Sharpie markers or grease pencils, and it's because they make some of the greatest disaster tools in the world. After the after Hurricane Katrina, it was probably 3 days into Hurricane Katrina, I was one of those nutty people watching television saying, why in the world aren't they telling people what to do to better their circumstance right away? Because we had celebrities going in and out, interacting with people. You know, we had Harry Connick Jr. come in, Harry Connick Jr. get out. We had media people in, media people out. People were interacting with stranded people and not telling them what they could do to better their circumstance immediately. So we called to say, if you can get people to do this one thing, it'll change their world. Here's just one thing. If they had taken a marker or dirt and water and had their names written in the largest letters possible across their chest and across their back, that would have done three things. Number one, it would have humanized us for each other. We wouldn't be the helpless, hopeless, stranded, faceless people. I'd be Anna Marie, Jean would be Jean, Mike would be Mike. We'd be community building 101. Number two, in a helicopter photo, your family would be able to recognize you. You might be all kinds of dirty, they're not expecting you there, but people, even if they didn't know what you looked like, they would be calling your family saying, I don't know if it's your Mike Collins, but it's a guy named Mike Collins, good looking, gray hair, you know, they'd be given the description, right? And you know what? Your family would be, in that moment, transported from being suffering victims, not knowing about loved ones, to in action, I know where I'm going to get him. Right? Number three, and I consider this to be one of the most important, if I didn't make it back, my family would still want my body back. They would not want to wait 6 months for it. And we are going to be spending millions and millions of dollars on DNA and dental record identification because we couldn't get a simple message through. Can everybody get that?
Yes.
That because of the nature of bureaucracy and the way that we do not have community-based preparedness so simply spread through the community, that people suffered unnecessarily, and we will spend millions of dollars because we could not get our acts together with something as simple as that. Can you get that? So, when I tell you to seize the teachable moment and to be the ones that shamelessly educate about the issues we've covered today, the need for our funding policies to change, the need to educate people on the difference between mass care and special care, the difference between funding organizations like Mike's and the organizations like the Council of the Blind, funding the organizations that have the expertise in dealing with your particular life circumstances, funding those organizations to be powerful, resilient, disaster-prepared organizations would make all the difference in the world. And I want to tell you something else. People all are always saying, oh, go out and participate in disaster preparedness and, you know, go out and be involved. And I completely agree. But I want you to think about being involved in a very different way than what you're often told. And one of those ways is to be that informed participant that changes the way people understand your needs. I'd point to a woman named Christine Seymour. She works with DACARA, Deaf Counseling Advocacy and Referral Agency. She is a late deafened adult, and she is awesome. When we had a community meeting where we were teaching disaster response skills, we were doing our basic class on how do you learn to mobilize your resources. In the state of California, we use something called the Incident Command System. How many of you are familiar with the Incident Command System? Only a couple of hands going up. But in very short order, what it is just a collective bunch of roles and responsibilities which will allow, say, a firefighter in any jurisdiction to be able to work with a firefighter in any other jurisdiction. And it's extremely simple. And here's the process. If you're in your home and you're cooking dinner, a fire breaks out, right? You put it out. You take your fire extinguisher, you put it out. you're then thinking about, okay, I have to call my guests, I have to order pizza, I have to do something different because this fire has now changed my plans. You go into the supply closet and you get the mop or the bucket or the whatever to clean up the mess you've made with the fire extinguisher. You have to figure out later, did my insurance cover this? How much did I pay for the mop and the bucket? And you know what? I needed to put on gloves or maybe a bandana over my mouth and nose so that I wouldn't, you know, be ill from the smell of the fire extinguisher. Oh, yes, and people are outside because there's smoke billowing out the windows. So you go to the window and you yell, "Don't worry, the fire is out." In that moment, what you have done is all of the major functions in the incident command system. When you stood up and took responsibility, you were the incident commander. When you did things like put out the fire, you were the operations team. When you were planning out, I'm going to need new dinner, I'm going to have to call my guests, you were being the planning team. When you got the supplies, whether it was the cleanup supplies or the extinguisher or the people to do it, you were being logistics. When you were figuring out how much everything cost, you were being the finance team. When you put on the glove and the bandana over your mouth, you were being the safety person. When you yelled out the window, you were being public information. And truly, all the rest of it is just scaling it up in size. In a huge disaster, fire departments are the entire operations, you know, their entire business falls under operations. So it's actually an extremely simple system to learn. When Christine was part of this group that's learning this system, we do an exercise called Titanic, where we pretend we're all beamed back onto the Titanic, and our job is to rescue ourselves off of the Titanic using the incident command system. So basically, you're going to be doing things like building rafts. We could have saved most of the people on the Titanic if we had known the incident command system, because big wooden doors float, yes? So if we had mobilized and gotten people to take the doors off the hinges, get sheets to tie the handles together, mobilized people to get them onto little floating rafts, we could have saved many people. Can everybody get that?
Yes.
Awesome. So Christine is in the group. Now, Christine is sitting there, and we had an ASL interpreter, right? So we had two different teams. On Christine's team, at some point, she signs to her sign language interpreter to stop signing. So now her team leader, and they're trying to figure out how they're going to rescue themselves off the Titanic, her team leader is suddenly presented with a deaf person with no ASL interpreter. So Christine made it real clear that she is deaf, she is not going down on this boat, and she is indeed part of the team. When we came back after the two teams had their moment, Christine's team had a very different result than the other team. What do you think it was? They kicked butt, okay? They kicked butt because Christine sat there not being, oh, I'm a disabled person and I need help. She forced them to pay attention and to make her part of the team. She was not going down on that ship. It was not going to happen. And she forced them to deal with her as an individual who was part of the team. Because she did that, their team thought about all the other people with vulnerabilities that might be on the ship. They had to be creative. They had to think of different ways that they would interact with Christine so that she wouldn't just be sitting there as a person not being able to participate. It changed their mind. It changed their mindset. It changed their awareness of what it means to build a team where everyone survives. Can everybody get the difference? Because she did not sit there passively or sit there doing the sign language interpreter thing so to make everybody else comfortable. She pushed the issue in a way that changed the face of reality for every single person on the team and for the class as a whole. So when you get the opportunity to participate in disaster-related anything, I would encourage you to look at it from that perspective. And I'll tell you, seize the teachable moment. People are afraid to ask questions. People are afraid to be offensive. People don't want to look clueless about disability issues. And one of the comments people make about me is, they'll say, is there any group that you feel uncomfortable presenting to? And I say no, because my client base are, you know, homeless agencies and, you know, I mean, that's my client base. And they say, you're very brave. And I said, what? Because that's not one of the things that I would have used to describe me. But the thing is, if you are not familiar or comfortable working with multiple diverse groups, people are afraid. So they come in with their prefab presentation. They're afraid to take the questions. They're afraid to be challenged on the issue. So one of the greatest things you can do is to be the ones that build that bridge for them. People don't want to be offensive. They don't want to say the wrong thing. They don't want to look clueless. So if you took on that your job is to educate people, your job is to make it comfortable for them, you will be giving them a service such that they never even realize they needed. The thing that I say in preparedness meetings when they're talking about disaster preparedness trainings in the community is I tell the story of a guy named Tim Crabtree. He lives in Colorado. He's quadriplegic. He's, I don't know, 20 years old. When he joined his school teen CERT emergency preparedness group, people didn't know what to do. Because if you have never, ever dealt with someone who has that level of disability, I mean, he is in a motorized wheelchair. It is tough for him to speak. You have to really, you know, he has to speak very slowly and you have to pay attention. A lot of people were just absolutely uncomfortable. They didn't know how to say, you know, they just didn't know what to do. As it turned out, having Tim in the class changed the world for all of them. Because over time, they had to get used to it. They had to build up their capacity to see him as a person. And he's a person with a lot of heart, and he's funny. But it all took that level of familiarity. And I would guarantee you they are better in emergency preparedness because of it. Because they have had to think through, what do I do with someone in a 200-some-odd-pound wheelchair? They all know something very different now than they would have known had Tim not participated in that. And then what he shared was, before the class, he had been thinking of committing suicide. He was very depressed about his life. And what he got from participating was the difference that he could make for people. So now he spends his time doing things like going to fire stations and saying, hey, do you want to learn how to take me out of a chair? Can everybody see the difference that would make if you made it that comfortable for people to be comfortable? I mean, truly, people are afraid. Sometimes they have shame. They've got fear issues. If you're the one to build that bridge, everyone benefits. Is there any question about that? Awesome. One of the things that I will leave as your... as a takeaway are my business cards. I have two of them, and unfortunately, we did not have the capacity to have them in Braille, and we do have some of the information in large font on our website, and I have certainly sent to Jean a PowerPoint version of this presentation, but the two cards that I have for you, one of them is a wallet-sized version of the incident command system. So all the things we talked about in terms of somebody has to be in charge, somebody has to be safety, that's in the wallet-sized version. And then our regular business card on the back, it has all the different vulnerable populations, because most people have never considered all the different ways people can be vulnerable. For example, registered offenders. Registered offenders in public shelters. Just have that sentence sit in your head for a minute and understand with Hurricane Katrina, thousands of pedophiles, registered offenders, and other clients of the criminal justice system took it as an opportunity to disappear into the woodwork, which only makes every single community where they land that much more vulnerable. Can everybody get that? I'll tell you in just one second. But the thing for you to do is, one, please make sure you have the cards, because you can be that force for educating others. And truly, again, you want to be the one that has the little disaster plan in your pocket, because whether or not you can see it, you become the one that can help everyone to be safer and more prepared. Can everybody get that? Awesome. Our website. Let me just give my website. It's the website is www.firstvictims.org. And what we tell every emergency response agency and every funder is, let's be honest, we know exactly who the first victims are going to be. Let's break the cycle and actually fund the ways that will make a difference for them. Now, you said you had a question.
Yes. How many non-disabled individuals are around disabled individuals at any particular time? And one whole day. Therefore, when I ask that question, I'm asking, they don't know anything about us, they're hesitant to get close to us, and therefore they don't know how to deal with us.
Well, that's part of it.
It makes it difficult for us to know how to deal with them.
Well, and I can tell you that there's some really basic things like, for example, carrying on you at all times, and I do mean at all times, not just the whistle and flashlight, but if you have information on your person at all times, and I highly recommend having something as simple as a little fold-out business card that gives people some of those stats. I mean, people don't know what would be the best way, for example, to guide you out in a disaster. They just don't know that. They've never done that. So it's the little things like, you know, whether you take somebody by the arm, you know, how you hook together so that you can be an effective guide. They don't know that. It's not natural for them. But if you break the ice, I guarantee you it's just easier on the other person. Because they're, you know what they're doing? They're standing there trying to pretend that they're not noticing that you've got a disability. Right? Because they don't want to be rude. They don't want to stare. They don't want to ask questions. And it's like, it just leaves them ignorant and scared.
Yes.
And then that leaves you in a less safe position. If you break the ice, life is better for everyone. And truly, carrying the information so that you are able to give them the information as to what they could do to be of true support would make all the difference in the world. I would take the card. If you handed me a piece of paper saying that this is the way you can help me, I would do it. But I'm not going to necessarily, I mean, I am a little more aggressive, obviously, because of what I do for a living, but the average person isn't going to come over and say, hey, friend, I see that you've got a dog there. What can I do to, you know, that's just not the way people do it. Other questions? Yes, in the back. Yeah.
Is it .org or .com?
.org.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes, in the back.
I recently visited the Capitol, and talking with Native Indians, I was surprised that once we started talking about the incident with Katrina, where service dogs separated from their owners, that was a total disbelief, a total shock. And the media is not putting out
sorry
some of
that.
The things
that
was
strong.
Second,
my crash
rate is
here.
I'm wondering, when I thought about it, I'm so glad to go to this day with my family.
We sit at the tables.
Right now, how many of us really hear about how dogs are separated from their owners?
What? What I would tell you is that the media needs to be educated in the same way that the general population needs to be educated, in the same way that the disability community needs to be educated. I mean, it's educate, 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 and seize every teachable moment. Here's something I got from the media folks. One of the things we've said to them is, you know, whenever you do a disaster story, you tend to do the same type of story. You tend to do things like put up the list of supplies, and you give the references and websites to FEMA and to Red Cross and to the Department of Homeland Security. What about people who have fear of dealing with any large bureaucracy? What about people whose needs will never be served in a public shelter? And what they say is, send me information. I mean, literally, it's not that they want to just be clueless. Nobody has taken the time to educate them. One of the things we shared with them, for example, in my county, we had siren systems that were put in, alerting and warning siren systems in several of the cities. Now, when we told the community agencies we serve about the siren systems, they all stepped forward right away, and they said, okay, for the deaf community, they're not going to hear the sirens. So what's in place to serve them? The Alzheimer Service Association said, you know what? It doesn't matter that the city sent out magnets and flyers saying that the sirens are going to be tested. They are not going to remember. They've got Alzheimer's. It went on and on like that. So what we did was we asked them, okay, well, what can you do? So they came up with all kinds of different things. The Meals on Wheels providers literally had, you know, garish-looking posters that they put with the meals and had the drivers verbally remind their homebound clients, today the sirens are all going to be tested at such and such a time. What we did was we took that information from the disability community and we educated the media. We called the media. We sent press releases. We did hand flyers. We did all sorts of things to let them know that when these sirens go off, after, you know, 9/11, when suddenly sirens are going off all around you, you are definitely going to think that something terrible has happened. You're going to have people calling 911. You're going to break the 911 system just by how many people are going to react very poorly to this. They jumped all over it. We had the media, one, show up to do nothing else other than take pictures of the siren and watch it go off. Two, and I'm totally not exaggerating, you could call Mayor Sheila Young from the city of San Leandro. She's like the total mayor of preparedness, and she literally held a press corps because we had so much media attention. They put it on the screen in large type. They put it on every radio station. They literally had it on the weather reports. They literally said things like, hey, tomorrow in Alameda it's going to be sunshiny, and don't forget those sirens going off at noon. I mean, they were totally on board. Why? Because we gave them what they needed to make the solution. We told them what the disability providers had said, and those disability providers were experienced preparedness people, because in the city of San Leandro, if you receive a dollar of San Leandro's funds, you have to take our classes. You have to be part of the response for vulnerable populations. I mean, is that not a slice of brilliance? I mean, very honestly, they already get this conversation that they're going to be people who need a different messenger, they need a different message, and they need a different medium of delivery. So it's an education thing. The media folks were all over it and happy to do so because they got to be the heroes. And by the way, in the city of San Leandro, not one 911 call. Not one, and dozens of calls from people saying, hey, you know, the siren in this area of the town wasn't as loud as you might want it to be because we couldn't hear it. I mean, do you get the difference of being an educated, empowered community to be appropriate advocates for your population? Awesome. Hand in the back.
Is there a system like this in other stations in Colorado?
We are getting requests like you wouldn't believe since Hurricane Katrina for how can they replicate the CARD model and the CARD curriculum, because, of course, everything we do is based on it has to be simple and low cost and culturally appropriate. But in most places, it doesn't exist for the same reasons that we mentioned earlier. All the money tends to go to the national organizations. They tend to go to organizations that are disaster response. You know, they're not focused on community building, et cetera. And by the way, the whole prosperity approach we take is actually not normal. People do not naturally associate this topic with economic development and prosperity. It's very deeply buried in bureaucracy and, you know, negativity. We've only got a couple seconds, but, you know, yep.
Where are those cards?
Yeah. Oh, we got cards aplenty.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else have any other questions to ask? Okay. I just want to make one comment. Is the question came up earlier about emergency evacuation shelters, and are those lists available? And I was at a meeting just recently, and the city of Sacramento said, no, we have 100 shelters, and the community was demanding them. And they said, we're not going to put that out because the facility, we may tell you, and you go to the facility that you think is the shelter, and that may be underwater, it may be out of commission, and therefore we're going to activate the shelter and get the word out the time that the area that you're supposed to go to. So I think that could be pretty true throughout the state, that they're not going to release that information because they're not going to activate all of them. They're going to activate those where it's safe to go and want people to move in that direction, rather than potentially going to the direction where it's hazardous and unsafe. Does anyone else want to say anything about that?
It's a huge liability issue related to the shelters. They really don't want to give out the list for multiple reasons. Of course, one of the obvious is we're in earthquake country, and if they told you to go to, you know, this place, and then that place happens to be the epicenter, then, you know, there'd just be enormous liability. But the thing that also you should remember is that almost any facility could, with proper training and funding, be an appropriate shelter if we needed it to be so. And those shelters that are not going to be operated by, you know, Red Cross or government or whatever, they've got a lot more flexibility in terms of what they can do. If Mike's facility turned into a shelter for whatever reason overnight, whether it was just for the staff or whatever, I'm pretty sure he'd be okay with service animals, wouldn't you say?
Maybe.
I mean,
depending on what they brought with them. We need food and water.
Could I ask if the shelters, has someone checked to see that they are accessible for all persons with disabilities?
Barbara, it's Mitch Pomerantz, and I will get into that, at least from our perspective, from LA's perspective, in a few minutes and give you an answer.
Okay, we're going to go on in a second, but and I'll get also Mitch and the others may have something to say that. I'm going to give another pitch. We're going to have at 2:45 p.m. during the general session, Grace Couch, who is the Deputy Director of Preparedness and Training for the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, is going to tell us about what state coordination is taking place with several agencies like the Department of Rehab, Social Services, and others. And understanding that she's going to talk about what steps are to deal with working with the shelters, including the American Red Cross, to bring that about. I know also that that's something that the United Animal Nation is working with them to understand the access needs, and also understanding that service animals are supposed to be permitted into those facilities. So I'd like to thank Hannah Marie Jones. I'm just having a leg cramp right now. Sorry, my sciatica. I got to stand. Excuse me.
Real loud whistle you were talking about. A lot of whistles aren't.
Okay. Anyway, I wish to thank her very much for coming from Alameda. Our next speaker that many of you know is Mitch Pomerantz, who is the second Vice President of the American Council of the Blind, first Vice President of the California Council of the Blind, past President of the California Council of the Blind, ADA Coordinator for the City of Los Angeles, and one of his areas of responsibility is dealing with these issues with preparedness. And he's coming today to talk to us about what the American Council of the Blind has done to educate its membership and other persons in the blind and visually impaired community and how to empower themselves in preparing. So I'm going to move this mic over to Mitch so he can take over.
Well, good morning to everyone. And I wouldn't be me. I know that Gene wants us to talk about what ACB is doing, but I have got to respond to at least our last presenter, because I think that there is so much truth in what she says, and I need to reiterate a couple of things. Last August, I was in Anniston, Alabama, at an old military base. FEMA invited 80 persons from the city and county of Los Angeles to participate in what is called these days a tabletop exercise. We were there for 4 days. We were given, we got a number of lectures and presentations over the first 3 days, or 2.5 days. In the last 2 days, we spent doing or working on a number of scenarios dealing with what do you do in case of whatever the disaster is, and we were given several. And my role for that period of time, I was part of the planning team to address the needs of special populations. And so I was sitting in this room answering phones, making phone calls, and reminding these various folks, do you remember that someone might need a sign language interpreter? Do you remember that this shelter needs to accept service animals? I was supposed to go down there and be trained. The real reason I went down was to train these people, and I assure you, and I've worked in government a long time, that it is absolutely true. Government's responsibility is to save the most people it can. And the plans that are in place will benefit primarily people who are non-disabled, who are ambulatory, and who have the means of getting the hell out of Dodge. So I needed to say that. We have had in LA City and County two major exercises over the past 6 to 8 months. Donna has participated in both of them. We've got another one coming up. And the comments that have come back, and I've seen the written reports I've sent to my staff there, has been, well, these people don't know how to deal with people with disabilities. Well, of course, these are volunteers. What do they know about disability? And when my staff sign language interpreter comes to me and starts complaining about this problem or that problem and they don't get it, I say, Angela, they're never going to get it because their job is to help the most people. It's like triage. You help the people who can fend for themselves. So I have to say that that the government does what it can, but government's job is to deal with the highest common denominator, so to speak. We attempt to help everybody, but we know in reality that's just not going to happen. With that in mind, the American Council of the Blind determined as a direct result of Katrina that we needed to take some positive steps to assist our members. We did lose members of ACB as a result of Katrina. We absolutely know that. There were well over 100 individuals in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama along the coast who were members who were affected by the hurricanes. We are aware, at least the last time I talked to Melanie Brunson, our executive director, of at least one fatality. We also know of at least one situation where an individual was separated from their guide dog. As a result, our director of advocacy and governmental affairs, Dayal Muhammad, sat down in consultation with our guide dog users affiliate and a number of experts in our organization and really combed the internet and the available literature to develop a comprehensive document which actually just got finished about 2 weeks ago. It's called Emergency Preparedness and People Who Are Blind and Visually Impaired. It is available now. It is available in all formats. I happen to have a Braille copy in front of me. And it is slightly over 15 Braille pages, which ain't bad. It is, Dirk.
What's the URL?
It's at acb.org. That's our website, and you can follow the prompts and get to it. It is on the web. So, you know, we do have special needs. And this document, it is comprehensive. It is not all inclusive, meaning that we have covered as many areas as possible, but there are still things that that are not covered here. The one area I read it. It was emailed to me, a draft, and to all of the board several months ago, and I read a draft then, and I just skimmed through it. One of the things that, for example, isn't included in here, interestingly, is the issue of bringing money with you, of always having money. But part of the reason for that is that this document is specifically geared toward issues that might only relate to us. And what the approach is that we have taken is to consider it, to look at it in terms of a three-ring analogy. We look at it as a simplified means of identifying and explaining disaster preparedness in such a way that it encourages a step-by-step proactive reaction. So it's based on the idea of three concentric rings, one inside the other. The centermost ring represents us as individuals. What do we need? Now, during most emergencies, unless it's a burning building or an unsafe or undamaged structure, most of us are going to be told to shelter in place and wait for further instructions from emergency management personnel. I have to stop and take a small diversion here. I get calls, and my staff gets calls from folks on a regular basis because we have an information and referral section in our department. And my most favorite, or perhaps my least favorite call, came from a woman several months ago. As far as I know, she wasn't blind, who told me she lives in the San Fernando Valley. And what is the city of Los Angeles doing to get her out? She said, those folks in Beverly Hills have escape routes. Have you got an escape route for me?
Did you tell her?
I told her a lot of things, but I didn't tell her that, Dominic. I said, well, first of all, you're probably safest in your home for at least the initial phase of the disaster, unless, you know, it's a fire or a flood or an earthquake damages your home. But she wasn't happy with that answer. But by and large, all the emergency responders are going to tell you that unless there is severe structural damage to your home, the best thing to do is shelter in place. Stay where you are. Now, Donna and I live up on the fifth floor of our condo complex, so we could handle a pretty significant tsunami or tidal wave. Plus, we live in Pasadena. It's not real likely. If a tsunami gets that far inland, we're all in real trouble. L.A. is gone by that time. But the center ring of this three-ring analogy is really a first step What basic supplies should we have? What things do we need to function as blind and visually impaired persons? And we, when we're talking about those or that part of the three-ring analogy, we're talking not just about us, but our guide dogs. And I won't go into to those details. Mike has covered that area pretty well, and Anna touched on it as well. So the kinds of things that they've talked about, enough water, enough food. I've got several weeks' supply of beer, which not only provides liquid, it provides vitamins and protein. So
we can barter with it.
Mike said we can barter with it.
And put it in a baggie.
Beer in a baggie. I'll have to experiment with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was also thinking the goldfish would be food for your cat too, if you needed to deal with that. So that's the first ring of this three-ring analogy. It's dealing with your and your dog, your guide dog's personal needs. And about the first half of this document covers that. The second ring out from the center, from the first ring, is an expansion of this concept, and that is person. This is one I think Gene focuses a lot on, and that is person in environment. Person in environment. What we mean by that, do you know what to do if you're at work or at a conference or a convention? Where's the nearest exit? What will your family do if you're all separated? Who should you contact? I have a great story about being at work and doing disaster preparedness. This was a number of years ago when I worked in personnel. Our division chief said, "Mitch, we need to set up a buddy system for you." And I said, "Okay, Dennis, if you say so, I think I could get myself out of the building pretty well." He said, "Well, I would feel much better if we set up a buddy system." So he assigns one of our clerical people to be my buddy in case of a fire or some other disaster.
What was her name?
Her name was Dixie. Oh. She was one of the original Dixie Chicks. Now, there's only one problem. There's only one problem with this setup. Dixie told me shortly thereafter that she has a hidden disability, and I don't know that our division chief was aware of it. Dixie had severe asthma. Now think about a fire and smoke. And what I said to Dixie, who was really a cool lady, I said, "Dixie, in case of a fire, I'll be helping you out of the building. A, I don't need to see to know how to get out of the building, and B, you're not going to be able to handle it real well with all the smoke and your asthma, so I'll probably have to put you over my shoulders and carry you out." Dixie did not disagree. Luckily, we never had to put the buddy system into practice. But the concept then is preparation, and Anna talked about having a whistle or a flashlight or being able in somehow to communicate. Now in LA, it's been real interesting. I've actually lived through three major earthquakes, but I was much too young to remember the Tehachapi quake of 52 or 53. But I sure do remember the Northridge earthquake of 94 and the Sylmar earthquake of 71. And both of those earthquakes occurred before people left for work, so that families were likely to be together. But the reality is that ain't always going to be the case. So the second section of this document talks about making those plans, for example, having an out-of-state or an out-of-the-area contact to check in with in case you get separated, knowing where you can meet with your family, your kids, your all of your loved ones in case you cannot get back to your home. Being aware, again, of your environment, your surroundings when you are at a conference. I work in a parking garage. I am not joking. Our office is on the first floor of a parking garage in the Wells Fargo building in downtown Los Angeles. My real concern during an earthquake is that one of those cars is going to come through the roof and squash us all, or at least squash me. But we have two very distinct and separate ways of getting out of the building. And assuming that that we don't get crushed in the initial earthquake or whatever, we'll probably manage to get out, although I am still of the opinion, and I think most of the experts will still tell you that during an earthquake, the safest place to be is indoors. There is a caveat to that, by the way, but I don't think we really have time to get into that. It's something I just recently read in terms of where you should be when an earthquake hits. But that's the second section of this emergency preparedness document that ACB has put together. Making plans for your family, being aware of your environment, and having a plan of action ahead of time. The third ring in this analogy is the community and being active in it. First responders, emergency planners, local transportation departments, and many other officials involved in emergency management are interested in knowing how best to serve the needs of people with disabilities. Now, as I said before, I agree with what Anna Marie said. Nonetheless, government does have a responsibility to try and assist. And the more input that we, I'm now wearing the hat of a government type, the more we have input from the disability community, from the senior community, the better chance we have. One of the things that my department, and I work for the LA City Department on Disability, one of the things we, I think, are going to be successful in achieving this year, even though the City of Los Angeles has a $200+ million deficit, we are working to get a dedicated position in our emergency preparedness department, a position to be held by an individual whose sole job will be emergency preparedness planning for the senior community and the disability community. Now, I think that as much as we can do, this would be a significant step forward. I mentioned earlier when I responded to Mike that we don't have a reverse 911 system in the city of LA. I want one. That's basically what Mike was talking about, where there's a computerized database and the people who have registered to be on that part of that database will be provided with emergency information via telephone. Normally, you call 911, you have an emergency. This system, the telephone, they call you. You get a recorded message like a phone tree. I was at a meeting last week with my deaf services coordinator, who is hard of hearing. He uses cochlear implants. And Richard who is not shy about educating emergency preparedness folks, said, you know, a lot of deaf people don't have radios. I get into Richard's car to go somewhere, and he doesn't have a radio, so I have to talk to him. And that's okay, except that Richard, when he drives, he looks at you because he, you know, it's a real exciting experience driving with my deaf services coordinator. So I would much prefer having a radio in his car. It wouldn't distract him, but that's Richard won't do that. But Richard made it very clear at this meeting we attended last week. He said, are you going to make sure that all of the information that is verbalized on television is scrolled, is captioned? And some of these people were well aware of that, but some others were not. And I then piped up and reminded them that during the fires in San Diego, three television stations failed to caption emergency information. The FCC stepped in and fined them. So I can't stress enough, you know, regardless of Anna Marie's comments, and they are right on, but regardless, we cannot ignore the responsibility we have to educate the first responders, the police, the fire, Office of Emergency Management folks, the community at large about our needs. Because while I think Anna Marie is correct that the agencies and the organizations that work with us are in the best position to address our needs, I am a hardcore political realist, and we're a long way, a very long way, from those organizations and agencies receiving the funding that they need to do a right job of it. Most of the money does go to the Red Crosses and the United Ways. Is that Audrey?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
Was the fine significant?
Yes.
To make it memorable?
It was five figures.
Thank you. All right. I'm glad.
First time, too.
Yeah, yeah. So this third ring, this third ring represents us as blind individuals offering our experience and our expertise to aid in the planning process to better serve our neighborhoods and our communities. And that document, or that section of the manual, takes up about the last fourth. If I had my druthers, I would have copies of this document in everyone's format of choice sent to every member of the American Council of the Blind. That's obviously not going to happen. We don't have a million-dollar budget to transcribe documents or to make documents available, but I cannot stress enough, given the fact that our members were affected by Katrina and by Rita, and the fact that the National Weather Service has predicted a higher than average number of hurricanes this year, the fact that at least in Southern California, I can't speak for Northern as well, but in Southern California, we have a major earthquake about every 20 years. 1933, 1952, 71, 94. We know it's going to happen. We know it's going to happen. It is not a matter of if. And in closing, and again, I said I frequently don't talk specifically or only about what I was told to talk about. I am going to put in a plug. On April 27th, our department and our Commission on Disability is holding a public hearing on emergency preparedness for people with disabilities. Anyone in the LA County area is invited and welcome and urged to come. It's going to be in City Hall from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. We are going to hear from representatives of all of the city departments and county agencies that have anything to do with disaster preparedness, and those of you who can attend can ask them all the obnoxious and embarrassing questions you'd like to. It is Thursday, April 27th in City Hall. We got bumped from Council Chamber. Originally was going to be there. It's going to be in the Department of Public Works boardroom, which seats a couple hundred people. One of the questions, for example, Barbara, you asked about emergency shelters. In the city of Los Angeles, our Recreation and Parks Department, interestingly enough, is responsible for the city shelters. Why? Because our senior and recreation centers are large enough to house significant numbers of folks, and by the way, most of them are accessible. But to follow up on Gene's comment, it probably is not going to be possible to publish a list of emergency shelters because there are liability issues and some of them may not be open. I would also say, in the presence of Mike Collins and Richard DeVilder, Richard heard this comment from me at a meeting we attended 3 or 4 months ago, it is a sad commentary that most of the state shelters, at least those that we're aware of in the LA area, are totally inaccessible because they're old buildings. And the folks who own those buildings are unwilling or unable to provide basic access. That's a problem, folks. We all have friends who use wheelchairs, or most of us do.
Bring it up your graces out.
Okay. So let me close. I hope you will contact ACB for copies of the document or get on the ACB website, acb.org. ACB's national 800 number is 800-424-8666. The document is called Emergency Preparedness and People Who Are Blind and Visually Impaired. Thanks, and we'll open it up for questions if that's your call, Gene.
What's the phone number again?
ACB number 800-424-8666.
I want to make a comment.
Well, just before we start with the question.
Sure.
I just want to find out, because I know there's going to be a lot of questions, if people want to make comments.
Okay. I want to see if any of the three speakers, Mike, Anna Maria, or Mitch would like to make any comments, final comments before we open. And
Yes, I will. One thing is, we may be quite far from breaking the disaster victim cycle that has us give all of our money to disaster response agencies, but bear in mind, we've got a lot of corporations right now who are looking for alternatives. Pacific Gas and Electric Company, the electric company, in my area, they are funding us to actually go across their entire service district to bring this type of training. The Northern California grant makers are looking at how is it that they can shift how they are doing their funding and how do we make this so that it works. So I would encourage you to raise the name of CARD and say there are successful solutions. And by all means, all of us have said the same thing, speak up in these public events. Truly, some of the reasons why we are getting the level of buy-in right now is because people are saying, have you heard of the CARD program based in Oakland? They're doing it very differently. So it makes a difference to keep speaking positively about this in every single venue you can.
Come down to LA.
CARD, it's Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters.
Mike, you want to make a last comment?
I'm okay. I'll leave room for questions.
Okay, Mitch?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had the last comment, so...
Go ahead. Okay.
Yeah, there are questions.
Then the questions. Go ahead.
This is Gloria Broderick. I just wanted to make a comment.
Hold on a minute. Well, let me just say, Gloria, then find out your nearest senior or recreation center for in Pasadena. Find out if the Jackie Robinson Center is going to be an emergency shelter. Find out the nearest senior citizen or recreation center in your communities, folks, and that might give you a leg up.
Okay. This is Pamela Beatty from San Diego, and question, actually. I heard a lot of talk about shelters, but not exactly how to get to them. And in cases of, like, the fire that was down there, many times the disabled were stranded, especially ones that cannot drive, and then their relatives and family could not get into the areas because it was under evacuation and no vehicles are allowed into those areas. How does one evacuate in the case of fire when you do not have access to a vehicle?
That's the important part of the evacuation plan. And I was down in San Diego when the fires hit in 83. And I was actually stranded for 8 hours out east of town. I had to drive back through Mexico in the middle of the night. But that's a whole other story. I had a vehicle. I was better off. I could move around and escape because the fires kept changing and they kept causing other neighborhoods and communities to be evacuated. One of the things we found out at that time is that we had to open the gate so that the paratransit providers could go back in to pick up more people because they can only bring two or three people and their possessions and their pets or the service animals out on a single trip, and then they had to go back because there were a lot of additional people in there. But your emergency escape plan should include what you can do if paratransit can't get there. What can you do if your family members can't get there? And you should also talk to the public service agency in your area, the fire department or the police or the sheriff, and let them know that you do not have transportation and they need to be aware of your presence so that they can be sure that their personnel check up on you and make sure you get out. And they can always, I see you're using a wheelchair too, they can always get you out of that wheelchair and get you in a vehicle and get you out to save your life. They may have to go back and get the wheelchair, or you may have to borrow one at the Independent Living Center. It is a temporary situation. And when you're being evacuated for your safety because there is danger there, whether it's a flood or a fire or damage from an earthquake. So, and if you want to talk more about that, we can talk afterwards. Thank you. And the lady in the second row in the blue. I'm Mike Collins. I'm with the State Independent Living Council.
Mike, you said that the paratransit providers should be certified for emergency evacuation.
Yeah, and I should clarify that.
How should that be done?
We're working with the CALACT, which is the California Association for Coordinated Transportation, to try to develop standards and a training program that they will put all paratransit drivers through in order to allow them to have in their vans a certificate, a big placard that they can lay on their dashboard in an emergency that will allow them to go past the barricades and back into the zones. They already do that now in San Bernardino County as a result of the fires they had down there and the number of people that were getting stranded. So this is something that's in development. It hasn't been completed yet, but if you're interested in it, talk to your local transit agency and ask them what they're doing to make that going. CALACT is the California Association for Coordinated Transportation.
Question just on that, in that certification, part of that training is preparing the drivers to have their own families in situation that they're prepared, so then they're not having to be concerned about what's happening to their families so that they can concentrate on responding?
Well, paratransit drivers cover a lot more than their own neighborhood. You know, they cover the whole city. And obviously, whenever your family is in a disaster, whether you're law enforcement or what your your job is, you're going to be worried about your family, and you're going to be checking on them as well, no matter what else you're doing. But
yeah,
they have a primary
that.
Responsibility, and I don't know exactly. We'll talk more about that, Gene, as we develop this thing, but it's in the development process now. Donna wanted to make a comment, and then our camera woman wanted to make a comment for K-Dirt.
One of the things that I wanted to say, and I'm putting in a plug for the city of Pasadena as well, we are working, our commission and the city have been working together, and one of the things we're doing, and we have the luxury of doing this because we're a smaller city that's, you know, I mean, it's smaller, but it has a lot of large resources. We have our own transit vehicles. And one of the things we're working on is being able to mobilize those vehicles in the case of an emergency, and they are all fully accessible to assist persons with disabilities and get them to these shelters that they won't tell us, you know, where they are. But but we do have the vehicles. That is, and we were able to actually try that on a smaller scale. We had a fire in a complex. There were a number of people with disabilities in there. Immediately, on a Sunday afternoon, we mobilized those vehicles, got them over there, and took the people to safe shelter. And they would not have been able to be transported at all if they didn't have access to those city vehicles.
Can I make one more quick response? And when Don is talking about vehicles, and this is good for you in San Diego too, think about the senior centers, the UCP, the ARC, all the different organizations that have vans, whether they've got them up with a public subsidy or not. Those vans are usually sitting around except during the week, during working hours when they have programs going. And your network for emergency transportation should include all those human service providers as well, besides the paratransit. So they need to be part of the solution in your community. And we had a question here from the camera woman. Do you want to use the microphone?
I'm Ann Evans, and I'm from K-Dirt and Davis Community Television. And I was interested in this, being a disabled person myself and my sister who's developmentally disabled. So I use the media as a way to educate people. And I get involved with doing programs. We have a radio show that is every week live, and it replays several times. And we bring disabled people in and issues and concerns. And Lena has been one of my guests and an activist, and not only using radio, commercial-free radio, but using public television. And we go out and do programs and involve disabled people and address the issues. So I want to connect with anyone else at this conference that are interested in like programs.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Whenever we get out of here.
Mike's hungry.
I'm not well, yeah.
Okay.
You don't have one of those emergency energy
I
balls?
Do. Well, I think on that note of a recommendation from Mike Collins, we will end the session, and let's give a hand to all our speakers.
Hey, Mitch, the problem is I need help opening it.
I got 3 days worth of food.